Good morning. I call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, April 24th, 2019. The time is 9:03 a.m. We are meeting in the Senate Finance Room in the State Capitol. Please silence your cell phones. This is Co-Chair Natasha von Imhoff. I am joined today by Co-Chair Stedman, Senator Bishop, Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski, and Senator Machicki. We also have President Giesel with us, and I see Senator Hoffman and Senator Kawasaki. We have a quorum to do business. So as a reminder today, Senate Bill 66, which is labor standards, safety, worker compensation, has been removed from this morning's agenda. So if you're here for that bill, we will not be seeing it. Up on the agenda today is Senate Bill 95, the Alaska Railroad Corporation land transfers, Senate Bill 10, extend the Suicide Prevention Council, and Senate Bill 74, Internet for Schools. Our first agenda item will be Senate Bill number 95, an act approving the transfer of certain Alaska Railroad Corporation land and providing for an effective date. Senate Finance first heard this bill on April 9, 2019. We took public testimony and reviewed the zero fiscal note. My office received no amendments and heard no concerns from committee members. Senator Wilson, thank you for joining us. Is there any further committee discussion on Senate Bill 95? Senator Wilikowski, can I have a motion to move the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 95 from committee with the accompanying zero fiscal note and committee recommendations.
Is there objection to moving the bill from committee? Seeing no objection, the bill moves from committee. Members, please be sure to sign the committee report as we move on to the next item. Number two, here we go. I'd like to direct members' attention to Senate Bill number 10, an act extending the termination date of the statewide Suicide Prevention Council and providing for an effective date, and invite Senator Scott Kawasaki and his staff, Jacob Garish, to present the bill. Please identify yourselves for the record and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, this is Senator Scott Kawasaki, District A in Fairbanks.
And Jacob Garish, staff to Senator Scott Kawasaki.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee for hearing this bill today. It's an important piece of legislation. As you know, Alaska faces some critical issues when it comes to health of our Alaskans and healthy Alaskan families. One issue that's of a crisis, it seems, is the rates of suicide within the state of Alaska. Alaska, at a time, ranked near the bottom, and right now we're number two as far as total number of suicides per capita. Senate Bill 10 extends the termination date of the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council for another 8 years. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council was created first in 2001, consists of 14 public and private members across the state, including four state legislators. Its purpose is primarily to advise legislators and the governor on ways to improve Alaskans' health and wellness and reducing suicide, to improve public awareness in suicide and risk factors, enhance suicide prevention efforts across the state, work with partners and faith-based organizations to develop healthier communities, and create a statewide suicide prevention plan, I think, which is in your packet today. The council holds public meetings across the state, publishes this five-year statewide suicide prevention plan, and works with school and community groups to provide resources to educate Alaskans on how to prevent suicide. Last year, the council was able to partner with the Alaska Community Foundation and the Children's Trust to continue the GCI Suicide Prevention Grant Program. Nine grants were funded across the state, including, I believe, school districts in just about every member's district who's seated here today. The council helped secure funding for the five-year grant with the National Institute for Mental Health to create the Alaska Native Collaboration Hub for Resilience Research, which will help Alaska Native communities share knowledge, guide research, and identify cultural relevant suicide prevention strategies for rural Alaska. If we do not extend the Suicide Prevention Council, this council will end in June of this year, and I think it would be sort of something of a heartbreaker if this weren't acted upon this year with the time we have remaining. So I just wanted to introduce Senate Bill 10 to the members and I'm free to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Kawasaki, as you look at the Suicide Prevention Council, and it's going to be extended for another 8 years, which is a fairly long time, how do we know that the Suicide Council's actions have been effective?
Thank you. Through the chair, thank you for the question, Senator Olson. We know that the this is a difficult subject to broach. One of the things that the Suicide Prevention Council has recently undertook, rather than dealing with the post-suicide phase and counseling, is to do prevention services. So they really have gotten into that that aspect. We know there's lots of factors that deal with suicide. Things like education, substance use, substance abuse disorders, access to mental health. Really to show the effectiveness of the statewide suicide prevention council would be to have no suicides in the state. I think we've seen some progress recently with the way they've undertook the new program as far as prevention goes. And if there's any other, do you have anything to add?
No.
Okay, hope that answered your question.
Madam Chair,
Senator Olson, follow up.
And I'm not trying to minimize suicide. Suicide is one of those travesties that we have to deal with, and especially it's in my district where there are a lot of suicides, especially amongst the young people, those that are disadvantaged. But what kind of, do you have numbers there that show that there would have been this program has been effective in being able to go ahead and give those people that are most vulnerable hope, so that they do not do the ultimate demise?
And through the chair, Senator Olson, I think I'd like to leave that to the council members that are here to speak to the bill today about ways that they've enhanced the system, new strategies that they're working on, and particularly the collaboration they've done with the Children's Trust and the...
Thank you, Madam Chair. No further questions.
Yeah, thank you. Senator Olson, we do have invited testimony today that we would definitely like to ask some questions to the executive director. Are there any further questions with the bill sponsor here? Okay, so who we have next is Chris Curtis. She'll be presenting the audit, and then, like I mentioned earlier, we will have invited testimony, and we will open this to public testimony as well. So thank you, Senator Kawasaki, and thank you, Chris Curtis, for coming up. So please state your name for the record, and please go through the audit when you're ready.
For the record, my name is Chris Curtis. I'm your state legislative auditor. I believe you all have a copy of the audit in your meeting packets. It's dated August of 2018. So overall, we did find that this council is operating in the public's interest by actively broadening the public's awareness of suicide prevention and by coordinating the efforts of other suicide prevention entities such as state agencies, regional groups, coalitions, and local communities. Additionally, the council did fulfill its statutory duty by producing the 2018 through 2022 Suicide Prevention Plan and by working closely with the stakeholders to add and refine the plan's strategies, resources, and indicators. We recommend an 8-year extension for this council. If there is some information in the audit, if you turn to page 4, you will see a schedule of expenditures and funding sources. This council is funded by general fund appropriations for just over $650,000 in FY18. You also see expenditures for this council, which were just under $600,000 in FY18. We do provide a list of council activities during the audit period. If you turn to pages 9 and 10 of the audit, we do list the activities the council accomplished during that time. You will see they're very an active council. And we have two recommendations for improvements. Both are administrative in nature and should be easily addressed. Recommendation number 1, on page 12, we recommend the council's executive director develop and implement procedures to ensure public notices for meetings are published timely and accurately. There are 18 meetings conducted during the audit period, and we found 5 were either not conducted or not published timely or not published accurately. The audit found the deficiencies were caused by a lack of written procedures. Recommendation number 2 is also on page 12. We recommend the council chair develop and implement procedures to ensure performance evaluations are completed annually for the council's executive director. Statutes require an annual evaluation. There should have been four conducted during the audit period. There were only two conducted, and it was unclear why the evaluations were not done as required. So again, both administrative in nature and both recommendations should be easily addressed. The responses to the audit begin on page 23. Both the council and the department concur with the report conclusions and recommendations.
Thank you, Ms. Curtis. Are there any questions about the audit? Okay, thank you very much. You do have invited testimony. We have on my list here Bev Schoonover, Executive Director of the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council. Thank you, Bev.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Beverly Schoonover, Acting Executive Director for the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council. I've been in this position since January. Thank you for your consideration for Senate Bill 10 to extend the work of the Council to 2027. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council was established by the legislature in 2001 and serves as an advisory council to the legislature and governor regarding suicide awareness and prevention. There are 13 volunteer council members appointed by the governor and four ex officio members appointed by the legislature. The council has one full-time staff member and is co-located in the shared offices with the Alaska Mental Health Board and Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. Currently, the council meets three times a year via video conference and holds one in-person meeting a year, typically in a rural Alaskan community. Senator Kawasaki read through our statutory duties earlier, but most of our council's activities involve coordinating collaborative efforts between stakeholders, supporting outreach and educational programs through the Suicide Awareness, Prevention, and Postvention Grant Programs, which is managed by the Department of Education and Early Development, advocating for federal and private funding, and providing technical assistance as needed. One example of our statewide coordination efforts was the completion of the five-year prevention plan entitled Recasting the Net, Promoting Wellness to Prevent Suicide in Alaska. Thanks to extensive public input and stakeholder collaboration, hundreds of Alaskans from all over the state participated in the creation of this plan. The number one goal identified in this plan by all of our stakeholders are that Alaskans should accept responsibility for preventing suicide. And what does that mean? That means that we think and we believe that everyone in Alaska has been touched by suicide. So it's the responsibility of all Alaskans to work together to prevent suicide and work to reduce and address the risk of suicide statewide. And that's really what this council does. We bring Alaskans together to talk about suicide and to evaluate what prevention efforts work. We advise agencies, the governor, and the legislature on how we can promote wellness and reduce suicide in Alaska. We coordinate state agencies and other entities so they can work together more effectively to prevent suicide. While there are other governmental and private sector agencies that have a common goal in the prevention of suicide, no other organization performs the statewide coordinator function. We ask that you please extend the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council to 2027 because we know that we have more work to do. Thank you, Senator Kawasaki, for your leadership on this bill, and to Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Hoffman, Senator Hughes, Senator Michicki, Senator Olson, Senator Schauer, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Wilson, and Senator Giesel for sponsoring this bill. Thank you. And please let me know if you have any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I think one of the you hit on your key role, which is the coordinating of the many local grassroots organizations that are all over Alaska. And by helping to provide communication and connection with everybody, support, convening meetings, whether it be online or once a year at a conference, those are critical and crucial so people can share stories, provide support with one another. And to me, that is one of your critical roles. And I'm glad that you're here and that you're doing that. So thank you. Do we have any questions? Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Atlas, good morning. Welcome to the committee meeting this morning. What are you thinking about to improve the inadequate resources? What are we going to do to try to double down, if you will, to get more assets out there in the community to drive this number down?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Thank you. And through the chair, Senator Bishop, we had, there was a vacancy at the Division of Behavioral Health for a while in suicide prevention, and that position has been filled by Leah Van Kirk, who's a prevention specialist. And Eric Boyer, who is working with the Alaska Mental Health Trust, has years of experience as a trainer. And with Eric Morrison, who's our project assistant, he's been with the council for a long time. I just have a feeling that the three of them and the council working together are really going to do some amazing things this year. And we've already started talking about some outreach campaigns that we're doing, some educational campaigns about reducing lethal means. And so that's coming out in the next couple months, which we're really excited about. And I just think that that brain trust, along with the very, very important brain trust and experience of the council, is really going to start moving some things forward this year.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you for also, it sounds like you're coordinating across agencies as well to bring the strengths of the different, whether it be health and social services, mental health trust. So I appreciate you going in that direction. I think that's a positive thing. We do have, are there any other questions for Ms. Bev Schoonover? We have a couple other folks here in the room, as well as I think online, who would like to testify as well. So thank you, Bev. Appreciate it. Bev is our only invited testimony, but the other folks in the room are affiliated with the Juno Suicide Prevention Council and so forth. So I'm going to open up public testimony at this time. So I see in the room we have Sam Trivedi. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Pardon me. I'm hoping you'll get to Sharon Fischel this morning. She happens to work at the Department of Education, and she has some specifics on some of the questions that have already come up today, so I know she's available online to speak. My name is Sam Trivett. I've been a resident of Alaska continuously for 65 years now. I've lived, worked, and volunteered all around Alaska, mostly in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau. I'm speaking today as a member of the Juneau Suicide Prevention Coalition, one of the local groups that you have talked about, and as a citizen of the state of Alaska. I want to thank Senator Kawasaki today for introducing the bill and for the 16 co-sponsors on the bill as of now. This is the third session that I've testified on the continuation of the Suicide Prevention Council in the last decade. I am a survivor of suicide loss. My wife and I lost our son Pete to suicide on June 28th of 2007. I've been a very active participant in the Juno Suicide Prevention Coalition for about 11 years. I've also been involved with the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council for about 10 years and have participated in a number of statewide conferences, regional conferences, and trainings with the council and other Alaska partners. The council has linked us to some of the national experts and resources that we have helped, that have helped us tackle this major public health problem affecting our country. The council is a glue that binds all of us together and keeps us working hard on suicide prevention issues. Alaska has done much work on this difficult issue in recent years, and I continue to volunteer because I continue to see positive changes year over year. A few examples. Experts agree that destigmatizing suicide and getting a person to reach out when they're showing signs of risk is a key prevention tool. Alaska has its own suicide prevention hotline called the Care Line, and they have put a lot of effort into getting the information out on it. And over the last four fiscal years, the calls to our Alaska hotline have increased threefold to over 21,000 calls last fiscal year. 21,000 calls. Each one of those is potentially a suicide prevented or someone reaching out in the early stages when there's a need. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council has worked diligently with its partners in recent years to improve the suicide prevention programs in our schools. And one great example, and I'm hoping that Sharon Fitchell will talk about this, but they've been working hard with the Mat-Su School District in the last couple of years and have done a tremendous job in improving the programs that are going on in the schools. I happen to have watched a video, a couple of videos, and had a couple of staff from the school district do a presentation here a couple of weeks ago. And I think if you watched it and understood where we started from 4 or 5 years ago, you'd see it's pretty amazing. The kids are engaged, the impact is real, and with the data so far in the 5 months that program has been running shows that the rate of kids being willing to contact an adult if they see a risk is over 42%. There have been a substantial increase in the number of Alaska hospitals and healthcare clinics that are screening for suicide risk now. That's a major change, and I personally, in this community, have every time I've gone in, unfortunately, to a hospital or a medical care provider, they're asking the question now. The efforts of public education are beginning to pay off. I ask that you continue support of the Statewide Suicide Council and their best practices. It does save lives. Thank you very much, and be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Trivette, for your testimony, and we're very sorry for your loss. You did mention that there's two folks that you'd like to hear from. I do see them online. Lisa, I know that you are signed up here, but if Lisa Parody, if you're not, okay. If we, okay, all right. I see we have Barbara Franks, Chair of the Statewide Suicide Prevention, and then Sharon Fischel as well. So Barbara, can you hear us on the phone, and could you begin your testimony?
Yes, I am. I could hear.
Okay, so state your name for the record and then begin your testimony when you're ready.
My name is Barbara Franks. I am with the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council, and I am with the National Suicide Lifeline that takes care of care lines across the country. But I'm with you here today as a mother of a child who died by suicide. Kind of difficult for me to talk sometimes because, you know, in December 14, 1997, my son died by suicide. 2 days later, my husband of 25 years lost his battle to cancer. And so it was really difficult. You know, I picked Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to grieve for my son. Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, I grieved for my husband. But, you know, it was ripping me apart. And so I knew there were a lot of people that were already advocating for the cancer. So I said, I need to help people because I didn't find anything in 1997. I didn't find a phone number to call. There weren't any support groups, you know, and, you know, a lot of us would remember what happened to my friends that I thought I had. But, you know, I found out later on through reading books and everything else that, you know, they didn't know what to say. And I'm here to tell you, you don't need to know what to say. I just need to know that you're close by, you know, that if I fall, you're going to be right there. My colleague, Cynthia Erickson, you know, she just got recognized from the U.S. Senate about her work with Grandma's House. You know, but she just doesn't talk about, you know, the domestic violence and sexual assault. She also talks about drugs and alcohol. But those are, to me, like cousins to suicide because, you know, no one dies by one reason alone. And looking back at the numbers, you know, people like to look at numbers and everything. And with the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, we started promoting how many people called the national suicide number in 2013. And even though suicide's been around for a long time, this date needed very special attention because even nationwide, That was the first time that there was 1,130,192 people that called the Lifeline number. Last year, in 2018, there were 2,224,408. And thanks to the work that Cheryl Fisher is doing, thanks to the work and advocacy of Sam Trivett, and to have the guidance and leadership on how to effectively come forward and safely by the guidance of Eric Morrison and with Beverly Schoonover. You know, we all need each other. And this is our one community as Alaska that we follow the National Strategic Plan, because we don't have time to reinvent the wheel, because there's so many reaching out for help. And as a mother, I thank you for listening to me and for your consideration on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Franks. We really appreciate your powerful testimony, and this committee is very sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
I see Sharon Fischel on the line, and while it says queue for questions, Ms. Fischel, you've been brought up by the two previous testifiers. So do you care to testify by chance?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Sharon Fischel. I'm with the Alaska Department of Education, and I manage all of the school-based programming that happens for suicide prevention. I'm here primarily to answer any questions that the committee may have around the school-based programming. And I am also a survivor of suicide. I also lost my son to suicide in 2010. So if there are any questions, any clarifications that are needed, I'm here to answer those questions.
Thank you, Ms. Fischel. When you say you coordinate with the schools, can you describe a little bit of that process? Is that the high schools? Is that around Alaska? Is it what is that program exactly?
So the funding provided through the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council has been and remains the primary funding source for suicide and trauma work accomplished through the Department of Education. This work has reached all of our Alaskan school districts in some form. We currently have over 23,000 users for our online professional development. The funding pays for grants to school districts, professional development, personnel, and admin costs here at DEED to implement the program. While DEED offers a collection of professional development resources to all districts, by far the largest and most popular are our online suicide prevention courses that have been supported through this funding. We also provide competitive school-based suicide prevention grants on a three-year competitive process to up to 10 school districts throughout the state. And each of those school districts do a variety of programming within them. We're in our second grant cycle currently. What I've heard from some of our current grantees from the Bering Strait School District, every year each district gives me reports on what they're doing. The Bering Straits also includes the Nome School District. They have a youth leaders program where they bring in groups of students to be leaders within their communities based around the Natural Helpers program, and they build protective factors among youth to reduce suicide. And one of their lessons learned was, we continue to learn that we are making a difference in the lives of students. They, in turn, are making a positive difference in their communities. It's really hard to answer the question, do you know how many lives we have saved? I can personally say that in the last 6 months that I have prevented personally three suicides within my immediate circle. So it's really hard to say how many we've saved. We know how many people have completed suicide, adolescents. We know that suicide is the leading cause of death for 14 to 24-year-olds in our state. But when you stop and think about it, even if I just stop and think about the ones that I have helped save in the last 6 months, how many of them out there have you saved and you don't know that you've saved them? And it's really hard to gather that kind of information. Our school districts are doing some phenomenal work across the state. I have a document that was sent to Senator Wilkoski's office this morning that kind of lists out who are our grantees, how much funding they have received, what kind of statewide professional development. We have over 23,000 users, as I stated, on our online professional development, and 18,000 of them have taken one of our suicide prevention courses or one of our trauma courses. I'm not sure how much into the weeds you'd like to get, so I'm going to stop and answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Fischel. Are there any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony, and thank you for the work that you do. And it is disheartening to hear the shared string that holds the three last speakers together, and we're very sorry for your loss. I see we have another person online, Ms. Katie Botts. Katie, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
You have a couple minutes for testimony if you'd like to state your name for the record and provide your testimony.
My name is Katie Boat. I do live in Juneau, Alaska, but I'm currently in Minnesota due to work. I am testifying on myself. Thank you, Madam Chair, and the members of the Senate Finance Committee for hearing me out. I typically don't talk about this kind of stuff, so please be patient. Alaska is known to be number two, and Alaska suicide is known to be number two in the country. Everyone has been affected by suicide, no matter if you want to admit it. Suicide is a taboo to even admit or talk about it in our state in various aspects. Not only have I lost multiple friends to suicide, but I myself seriously considered suicide from 1999 to approximately 2004. There are people I would write a goodbye letter, have a journal, write a goodbye letter to all of my family, my friends, anyone who associated with myself, and I would hide it so that only I would know where it's at. And then every time that I went across the Kodiak Bridge to my father's boat, I would see myself falling off of that bridge every time. There are many people who don't know where to turn to for support. Many people don't have a support system. So please show that you truly care by continuing to support suicide prevention. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie, for your testimony as evidence of how important it is to have a support system in place. Is there anyone else online? Anyone in the room? Seeing and hearing none, public testimony is now closed. So in addition to Ms. Schoonover, we have the following people available for questions. We have Linda Brazik. Are you here? Okay. She's the Administrative Operations Manager in Division of Behavioral Health in the event that we have questions for that department. But Ms. Brazik, I think I have you here on my list to present the fiscal note. Are you prepared to do that?
I am actually not prepared.
You are not prepared to do that. Okay. I'm going to do an at ease real quickly. Back on the record, I am going to have my trusty co-chair present the fiscal note. Co-chair Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. We have one fiscal note with us today from the Department of Health and Social Services, appropriations under behavioral health and the allocations under Suicide Prevention Council, and the OMB component number is 2651, and the date of this publication is 4/10/2019. We have $648,400 included in the governor's FY20 request, and then it goes on up and or excuse me, stays flat for the next 5 years. Madam Chairman, so it's pretty straightforward fiscal note, $648,400 a year to run the program.
Thank you, Chair Stebbins. Any questions on the fiscal note? Okay, we are going to set Senate Bill 10 aside for further review. Please let my office know as soon as possible if you have any concerns or amendments. Okay. Our next agenda item is Internet for Schools. We have a CS for Senate Bill number 74, an act relating to funding for Internet services for school districts. I'd like to invite Meriden Barrio, staff to Senator Lyman Hoffman, to present the bill.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Meriden Barrio, staff to Senator Hoffman. Thank you for hearing SB 74 today, and Senator Hoffman sends his apologies for not being here himself to do that. SB 74 increases the broadband requirement for schools from 10 megabits per second to 25 megabits per second of download speed and provides funding to help schools reach the 25 megabits per second through the School Broadband Assistant Grant, or the BAG. Districts that qualify for discounted rate for internet services under the Federal Universal Services Program are eligible. The Universal Service Administrative Company, Schools and Libraries Program, commonly known as E-Rate, provides discounts of up to 90% to help eligible schools and libraries in the United States obtain affordable telecommunications and internet access. The school BAG was established in 2014 by the legislature and created to assist schools to reach internet download speeds of 10 megabytes per second. Currently, the grant funds may be used to cover eligible costs incurred by the school districts for schools that have less than the 10 megabits per second each fiscal year. Since 2014, new and improved technologies and increases to internet services have allowed for more and faster delivery of internet services. Because the cost of internet in some rural districts has decreased, the annual internet costs have fallen below the 2014 benchmark established by state law. To allow school districts to utilize these advances, SB 74 will increase the minimum requirement, the requirement of megabits per second from 10 to 25, which will increase the amount of broadband assistant grants that the state can pay to school districts. The funding leverages federal E-rate funds at approximately 8-to-1. The program allows for leverage for up to 9-to-1 based on a formula for free and reduced lunch calculation by district. Thank you for hearing SB 74 today. If there's any questions, I can try to answer them.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I see on the in our packet here we've got a list of schools and the annual cost of the internet, but on the first page there's Community Angoon that's in the district I represent, Madam Chairman, but they have fiber optic, that fiber optics cable that comes up Chatham Straits, beachheaded in their community for a repeater or an amplifier, whatever it is on the line. So it'd be nice to find out why this community doesn't have extremely fast internet in their school, having fiber optic laid right on their front door.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I can generalize why that is, but I would imagine that would be a question probably for the telecommunications companies, but sorry.
I think that's a very good question. I think as we look at the efforts of both GCI and Quintillion and others, and we look at maps, we should see where there is fiber optic cable and what determines close by. Senator Stebbins.
Yes, Madam Chairman, just on a follow-up on that, and then with the fiber, if we could kind of keep an eye on that as we look at this program, you know, in the more communities we can hook up to that fiber system, you know, more opportunities the whole community has, much less the school. So.
Yes, internet connection is good for tele-education and for telehealth, among other things. So if there's no further questions, we do have Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In FY19, we had about 80 schools that were upgraded. Are those 80 schools in the 172 count in this bill, or are they not within this count, the ones that were already upgraded in FY19?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilson, the count you're referring to from the districts that I provided, or so there were in FY19, they expect 80 schools in 20 districts to reach the 10 megabits per second with the school broadband assistant grant. I'm sorry if I misunderstood your question.
No, that's fine. I can pass on that. But I do have another question, Madam Chair.
You have another question, Senator Wilson?
This is for all schools within the Rail Belt and rural districts. Is there a priority of maybe more of the rural schools than schools that are on the Rail Belt?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilson, it's my understanding when this program was created that it was to assist rural school districts primarily, but all school districts in the state can apply through the E-Rate program and then through the BAG program. So it's not limited to rural school districts.
Thank you.
So thank you. We do have folks from the Department of Education and Early Development that hopefully can answer some of these technical questions as well. So any further just general structural bill questions for the bill sponsor? Okay. Thank you very much. We have two invited testimony. First, we have Ms. Lisa Parity, Executive Director of the Alaska Council of School Administrators. Thank you, Lisa.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, good morning and thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of SB 74. For the record, my name is Dr. Lisa Skiles Parity. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Council of School Administrators. And in that capacity, I represent Alaska superintendents, elementary and secondary principals, school business officials, and the host of school administrators that are serving our students across Alaska every day. This morning, I'm also represented my colleague, Norm Wooten, the Executive Director of the Association of Alaska School Boards, who was unable to be with us today, so I'm speaking on both of our organization's behalf. I first want to thank the bill's sponsors, thank Senator Hoffman, Senator Bishop, and Senator Olson for introducing this bill, and also the additional co-sponsors, Senator Stevens, Gray Jackson, Hughes, Von Imhoff, Michiki, Costello, Begich, and Schauer for sponsoring the bill. That level of support is greatly appreciated. This bill, as we've heard, increases the minimum broadband requirement for school districts from 10 megabits per second to 25 megabits and provides funding to help schools reach that 25 megabits through the School Broadband Assistance Grant. I was closely involved, as Senator Olson will recall, with bringing the first broadband assistance grant forward in 2015. At the time, I was working for the North Slope Borough School District, and it was then that I saw that our villages, our sites at our villages, 11 villages spread across 89,000 square miles, the largest district in the nation, almost the size of Minnesota, those villages had one meg, our schools, two megs. And in speaking with our educators, our teachers, who were trying to teach our children, you know, they just, doing it through technology was virtually impossible. And so it was at that time that I worked closely with legislators to bring forward the first broadband assistance grant to start to incrementally move our ability to increase bandwidth across the state. And I think we see this bill as that next step to incrementally connect Alaska, as it's unlikely in our current financial situation that we're going to connect the entire state all at once. The last I understood, that cost would be in the range of $2 billion, and it's probably escalated since that point. So again, is it the solution? No. Are we seeing some efforts, as Senator Stedman just referred to connect different parts of the state, and districts are taking advantages of those to the degree possible, but we're not there. And this really is that next step to kind of bump it forward and keep adding connectivity. When we did the original grant, it was focused for all schools because the point was to set a floor, to try to bring all schools in the state to at least a floor of 10 megs. And I feel really excited for all of us in education and for the legislature. It's incredibly good policy, and we've been able to do that. But let's be candid, 10 megs is just not where we want to stay. So our members every year undertake an opportunity to really prioritize what the positions they are going to take on education policy are. So across everyone that we work with, they do what are called joint position statements. Many of you are probably tired of seeing them this session because I've been giving them to you over and over, but the increasing bandwidth in outlying areas is one of our members' highest priorities. And I just want to take a second and read to you briefly what that position is. And it's Alaska students need and deserve the full transformative power of technology and equitable access to online resources. Students, teachers, and school leaders of Alaska, some of whom live in the most remote areas of the world, require access to modern technology in order to transform learning, create efficiencies, provide online health services, and keep pace with their peers globally. The Alaska Council of School Administrators and our members support continuing the broadband assistance grant and increasing the level of state-funded bandwidth for schools to 25 megabits of download per second. This funding leverages federal E-rate funds at 8-to-1, sometimes 9-to-1, to provide Alaska students and educators fair access to the digital world. As of 2017, there were an estimated almost 60,000 students across the state that still lack access to bandwidth needed to support the integration of technology into classroom instruction. And I know you know that technology used to be an add-on. You know, it was core instruction and then there was technology. But that terrain has shifted. Technology is core. It has to be integrated in our education services to our students, and we still just don't have access to it in many places across Alaska. Reliable access to the internet is a critical component of modern learning, and many of Alaska students can't access the internet levels which meet FCC minimum connectivity goals. So passing SB 74 this session is important. Our members see this as an important step to continue to provide equity with connectivity. And as I stated, it's a 9-to-1, in many cases, E-rate match, which is a great investment to provide access to students. And the timing I want to speak to just for a second, we really asked the legislature to pass SB 74 this year. Last year we had a comparable bill that made it to the last day, the last discussion of the budget, as you know. And we worked hard for 2 years to get that passed. And here we are again, and we're grateful. But it really is our hope that you will pass it this year. Districts apply for discounted internet through the E-rate program. The annual filing window to apply is the end of March each year. And that's generally before you as a legislature finish your business. So it's really important for us to pass the bill this year so that next spring the Department of Education can tell broadband assistant grant eligible recipients that they can apply for 25 megabits per second rather than 10. So they have already told districts you can't apply for 25 this year because that March window is passed. So we are already locked in again unless we can figure out a waiver or some way to work with that, but on its face as it is, we're locked into a 10 for another year. So passing this bill this year allows for us to not be in that situation again next year. So timing is critical. We want to ensure and help all schools, no matter their geography, have equitable access to educational opportunities. Quality education requires connectivity. Passing this bill will help us achieve our goal of ensuring that every Alaska school has the access they need to provide our students with the education that they deserve. So thank you so much for your time and consideration, and we hope you will look favorably upon this bill, and we stand ready to answer questions or assist in any way.
Thank you, Ms. Parody, for your comprehensive testimony. Senator Marchicki.
Thank you, Ms. Parody. My interest in this bill is the potential to reduce costs across the state for education. In your assessment, do you believe that there'll be an offset that equals this investment in the long term for a better education where perhaps some urban resources can be shared for a better result rurally?
Madam Chairman, Senator Marchicki, thank you for the question, and I'd answer it two ways. First, an investment in our students' education reaps great rewards, and in this case, we're denying students the full access to what's available in terms of professional learning opportunities. But I think in terms of financial, you know, we see this as an opportunity to extend the great reach of incredible teachers to other parts of the state. So, for example, you may not have an AP chemistry teacher in rural Alaska that you might then be able to provide access to those rural schools through a larger district that has that. Today, that's very difficult to do, if not impossible. So I think that there is the opportunity to enhance those opportunities for students across the state by extending the great reach of educators. Having said that, you know, I think it may not, I don't feel comfortable saying that yes, there will be a savings on this end that would justify the cost of investment on this end. If you were talking about just dollars, it's possible, certainly. But I think that there definitely is an opportunity to give greater access to learning from students around the state by collaborating with and between districts. And districts have stepped up repeatedly, you know, wanting to do that, being willing to do it. The problem is, of course, connectivity. So I think if we keep working on that, you're going to see those opportunities to share seat time, to, you know, do some of the really innovative work that we see happening around the rest of the country in terms of sharing educators across the state.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. Is there any research on how increased screen time affects educational outcomes in K through 12?
Madam Chairman, Senator Wilikowski, I believe that there is a body of research, and I am not current with it, but I'd be happy to provide some. You know, go look for it and bring it back.
Thank you. So we do have a couple other folks for invited testimony, as well as we have several superintendents on the phone, and so thank you, folks on the phone. Thank you, Ms. Parody. So folks on the phone, if you could just hold on a little bit while longer. I do have, I believe, Patience Fredrickson, the Department of Education and Early Development. Patience, we're also going to have you eventually go through the fiscal notes, so are you prepared to do that?
Yes.
Okay. So we'd like to have you start your testimony, and included in your testimony, if you could help us kind of answer, why were the schools chosen on your list? Thank you.
Patience Fredrickson, Director of the Division of Libraries, Archives, and Museums, Department of Education and Early Development. The Alaska State Library has administered the school bag grants for the entire length of this program. It started out as a $5 million program and is now down to about a $1.5 million program. We saw the highest number of schools that needed assistance at 135. In the second year of the program, it's dwindled down to 80 schools needing assistance at this point in the program. And we believe that's because there's more robust internet in the those places where these schools are, and so they are able to get more than 10 megabits per second, and they can afford it without statewide assistance, without the school bag grant. So they're choosing to opt out of the program so they can go to a higher level of internet. The program is operated with one part-time librarian, and it seems to have been very effective. The fact that it has 11 sponsors and co-sponsors on the Senate side indicates, I think, a strong belief in the value of internet equity around the state. The fiscal note. Do you all have the fiscal note that's about $7.1 million in your packet right now? Okay. We submitted a fiscal note originally at 245 schools. We received a question about that. 245 schools that were under 25 megabits per second. We did a search of the FCC database and came up with 245 that we used in the first fiscal note. On further questioning, we reviewed that list that we had from the FCC, and we realized there were a number of schools that were getting internet twice, and they were applying for E-rate twice, and they were being funded twice, so we masked out those doubles. We are now down to 172 schools that need assistance getting to 25 megabits per second. That has changed the fiscal note from about $10 million down to about $7.2 million in the first year of the program. So that's a substantial decrease from $10 million to $7 million, which we hope will enhance your interest in passing it. Lost my track of thought. The program is costing $1.5 million this year, and so we would need about $6.6 million with the $5.6 million with the $1.5 to add up to the $7.1 million. I was asked if I could if we continued to run the school bag program at 10 megabits, we would need $1.5 million, and then we would need additional money on top of that. So the cost for FY20 is $7.1 million, and if you subtract out the $1.5 million that's in our current program, it comes in a little bit lower, actually. I hope I'm not confusing you on that. I think I'm confusing myself. I believe that's all I wanted to address right now. At this point, if you have any questions, I can answer them.
Senator Bishop had a question followed by Senator Wilson.
Thank you. I'd just like to, I know the members probably know it, but in case they don't, you know, the fiscal note does go down in the out years because there's a 3% reduction based on the funding patterns and the bag formula in the out years. So it does go down to 6.3. Thank you.
Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering about how many schools per year will be served and that will be, I guess, upgraded to 25.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, we're anticipating 172 schools are eligible for the program as of March 2019 when we pulled the list from the FCC. What we experienced was the highest number of schools in the second year of the program. It takes them some time to make sure they have the capacity to get the 10 megabits in, and we think that might also happen that they can't immediately take advantage of the 25 megabit money. So the second year of the program will probably see about 172 schools. But as the cost of internet decrease in those villages, then we see that reduction, and that's what happened with the current program. The initial program in FY 2015, the average award was $29,000 per school for internet support from the school bag program. It fell to $17,000 by the end of the program. So we're expecting a decrease in the actual cost of the internet to follow that pattern we've seen over the past 5 years.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. So just a quick question just to kind of clarify. There's 172 schools across Alaska that have 10 or less megabytes.
Chair, no, the
25 or less.
25 or less, yes.
25 or less. So with this $7.1 million, along with the 8.1 match through the BEG program with the federal government, these 172 schools can be brought up to at least 25 megabits. Over how many years will it take to get them all ready to go?
If the Chair Von Imhoff, if the infrastructure is in place in the places where the schools are under 25, they can get up to 25 the first year of the program. If there has to be additional infrastructure from the telecommunications company or the routers within the school, whatever sort of infrastructure has to be added, that is not included in the BAG program. And so sometimes it might take up to 2 years to hit the maximum of 172 schools getting assistance.
So thank you. Along that, who's going to pay for those routers and infrastructure to outfit those schools?
Chair von Imhoff, in the previous version of the program at 10 megabits, the school districts paid for that.
Okay. Senator Machicki.
Just, it may have been the way you said it, but there's 1.487 million in the governor's budget right now for the 10 megabit program. You're essentially saying this 7.1 is going to replace that 10 megabit program. So the fiscal note is 7.1, but that's just going to replace the 10 megabit program. So for the difference of 5.68.
Through the chair, yes, Senator McMichael.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further questions? Thank you very much for presenting the fiscal note. We appreciate that. Now we're going to go to the phone, and we have a bunch of folks waiting here. So I'm going to open up public testimony at this time. So the first person who signed up is Mr. Daniel Walker, Superintendent of Lower Kuskokwim. Mr. Walker, can you hear us, and can you begin your testimony, please?
Yes. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 74, and thank you to the committee for consideration of this important piece of legislation, and it is my hope that it will get passed this year. For the record, my name is Daniel Walker, and I'm the superintendent of the Lower Kuskokwim School District, headquartered out of Bethel, Alaska. LKSD is the largest RAAA in Alaska in terms of number of schools and number of students. We have 27 schools, 22 of those are in our remote villages. We have 5 schools in Bethel and a youth facility. We have approximately 4,100 students, 95% of which are Alaska Native, and our poverty rate is a little over 90%. We have approximately 350 certified teachers and almost 1,000 employees. I've been involved in education in LKSD for over 27 years. From the time there was no internet connectivity through its infancy and witness to the growth we have made. I strongly believe access to broadband internet helps to level the playing field for rural students who would otherwise not have access to the high quality resources our teachers use every day to engage with our students. LKSD has been on the forefront of building a distant learning network for our schools. Our school board and administration views investment in broadband access as a critical teaching tool to help engage students in our digital age. Our students are able to connect with teachers and other students using our two-way interactive video conference system. This is incredibly important because in our small rural schools, it is impossible to provide a highly qualified teacher for every subject area. LKSD currently operates 5 teaching studios offering 15 different classes across the school district that range from social studies, language arts, science, math, all the way to dual credit college courses. And these classes impact several hundred students each year across our 27 schools. When we consider the amount of broadband needed to support personalized learning, and our current amount simply cannot support the sort of media-rich content needed to provide that experience for our students. LKSD has spent considerable effort in optimizing our bandwidth through the use of appliances that cache certain media-rich content, and that has helped. But overall, we are woefully short of the FCC target range of 1 megabit per student. We are currently at less than 10% of that recommended bandwidth per student that is suggested by the FCC. Additionally, we use our video conference system extensively to connect to our remote villages to conduct meetings and professional development. And while it does not replace the face-to-face meetings, it is critical to our mission and building capacity for our school leaders and teachers. SB 74 will make a significant impact in our ability to continue to increase our capacity and provide rich learning and a rich learning environment to our students. SB 74 is critical to this effort, and I urge the Senate to pass the bill this year. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Walker, for your testimony. We do have several people signed up today. Next, we have Brett Agenbrode, Pribilof School District Superintendent.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Brett Agenbrode, Superintendent, Pribilof School District. The Pribilof School District has recently been reduced to a one-school school district. We do run an online correspondence program on St. George for the six students there. I would note that the Pribilof Islands are not only rural, but they are remote. We have 59 students in the St. Paul School, K-12, and just a little anecdotal history on us. For the past 6 years, we've had a different math and science teacher every year, and it's just failed us or failed our students in the sequential progression of the math-science curriculum. People come in, they start at different places, they can't identify where a student is, skill level-wise, et cetera, teach to the middle, that kind of thing. So this year we went out and talked to a number of districts in the state to see what kind of computer-based curriculum or learning programs they were using. And we're piloting one this year. And the idea being, with the online curriculum in math science, we're using it in math 5 through 12 and in science 6 through 12 daily. We're currently blocking all teachers and other grade levels from 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. just to maximize our 10 megabit bandwidth. And just let me explain that a little bit. The computer-based program we're using has a cache server in the St. Paul School, so all the videos and the content are housed here locally. So we're really just running back and forth to the cache server as students are doing most of their work. The only time we go outside into the real world of the Internet is when a student answers a question, completes a quiz, or takes a test. Then those answers are, you know, in microseconds, shot to Kansas City and back, and the student is either prompted to go on or go back and reteach, relearn, and retry. And so we have 10 megabits down from the real world, but only 2.5 out. And so that's where the pipe on the 10 megabits narrows dramatically for us. Even using a cache server, it's trying to get data pushed from St. Paul out. And so if we don't block the rest of the faculty and staff and other grade levels, our students begin to drop off. So a kid will be working, or the largest class we have is 20. That's for 1 hour a day, and then it's 16 would be the largest class, and the other one is 10. And they're on it only one class at a time on the Internet. And so anyway, that the 10 down and 2.5 up is a problem for us if we have anybody on but students. The weather is another contributing factor. When we have wind or snow or heavy rain or heavy overcast out here, because ours is satellite-based, we drop 30 to 50% in our efficiency. So some days we only can keep like half the class on the computer-based system. You know, there was a question about economics or educational outcomes based on FaceTime on computers. And again, while I don't have a lot of evidence, it's just common sense, I think, to the teachers that have been using this program this year and myself, who's been monitoring it and talking to students and teachers about the effectiveness, that a coherent and sequential program in math and science in these extremely rural or remote locations where we can't keep a teacher or find a qualified teacher year after year. This program tracks these students. So the idea is the curriculum
Mr. Eggebrand, can you wrap up your testimony, please?
I can. Will not change. Teachers may change or facilitators. So it's vital to us to be able to reach out and get a computer-based system. But I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Senator Machicki, you have a question.
I do. So I asked earlier about cost. So we hear some folks complain about the cost of education and the outcome of education. Do you see this as increasing the interest of students, which may result in higher graduation rates or a better outcome as far as preparedness for either a vocation or college education?
I would say definitely better preparedness. And I don't know that I caught the full question, but it's our feeling, teachers, students, and myself as the administrator, that having a coherent tracking and a sequential pathway for students through the material versus having a teacher in and out every year who starts or stops or reteaches a subject. This way we can track kids, they get instant feedback. So again, I think academic preparedness is what we're gaining from this right now. We're also able to give, you know, SAT tests, or a MEPS certified testing center. The tribe's not using our bandwidth, but they're offering a lot of college courses. They're developing an education center here where people can get vocational and higher education in the community. So internet learning, the tribe's doing it and moving into it. We're doing it, moving into it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony. Now, I see that we have someone in the room. Is Mr. Sam Jordan in the room? Nope. Okay. He's online. Mr. Jordan, are you online? Oh, I apologize. Okay. Are you available? Can you hear us? And if folks, I'm not timing people for their testimony today. I'm being a little bit more just casual about it, but please do not take advantage of that, and please keep your testimony at or around 2 minutes out of respect for several others that are also on the line wishing to testify. Thank you. So, Mr. Jordan, are you here?
I am, yeah. Thank you very much. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sam Jordan, and I'm an educator and a parent of two school-aged children here in Juneau. I appreciate the opportunity to speak in support of SB 74 on Internet for Schools. You know, as I did with radio and TV and video in the past, schools in Alaska have embraced the Internet as a great tool for delivering instructional opportunities for students and for providing professional development to their staff, as well as allowing communication and coordination among school districts. Education technology has grown considerably in its effectiveness over the past 10 to 15 years. Many schools in Alaska have been able to keep pace with these opportunities as their internet broadband capacity has allowed, but much of the software in recent years has become cloud-based, and the size of the software as well as the demand on broadband capacity has grown. So this bill aids schools in keeping pace with those increasing demands. And more importantly, it empowers small rural districts to remain engaged with the latest instructional technology opportunities for their students, especially if we're going to begin to allow districts to have opportunities to share classes, as was referred to in some of the other testimony, allowing students in rural areas to take advantage of more specialized subjects taught in hubs. We need to support that infrastructure and allow equitable education opportunities for any student in Alaska, no matter where they reside. So I thank you for supporting this bill and for the opportunity to testify this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Jordan, for your testimony. Next we have on the line, who signed up also around 9, was Mr. John Conwell, the Unalaska City School District.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Conwell. I am superintendent for the Unalaska City School District. Our district has participated in the Broadband Assistance Grant Program since it was first offered. In incremental steps, we've been able to grow from a 3-megabit connection 4 years ago to our current connection of 20 megabits. This 20-megabit connection is shared through a consortium agreement between our two schools with a total enrollment of 425 students and the local public library, which serves hundreds of patrons each month. With our current 20 megabit shared connection, we are still unable to offer our students basic access to the digital educational content that is commonplace in most other parts of Alaska and the lower 48. Even with some creative bandwidth shaping throughout the day, we still do not have the capacity to offer online assessments such as the state-mandated performance evaluation for Alaska students. In fact, Unalaska is just one of 8 Alaska school districts who administer the PEAKS via paper pencil due to bandwidth limitations. With the increased broadband support provided under SB 74, internet speeds will be increased for many rural Alaska students that are not yet connected by high-speed fiber optic cable. This will give hundreds, if not thousands, of students and their teachers more access to the educational content and services offered through the internet. I'd like to thank Senator Hoffman and the co-sponsors of this bill for your leadership in closing the digital gap for students in rural Alaska. Again, I urge you to support SB 74, and I thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Conwell, for your testimony. Next, we have Patrick Mayer, Superintendent of Yakutat School District.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patrick Mayer, and I am the superintendent of the Yakutat School District, the president of both ASA and AXA, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify on SB 74. Thanks to all sponsors and co-sponsors of this bill, it is encouraging to see such broad band support. Little joke there. I am in total support of Dr. Parody's testimony. Alaska's students need and deserve the full transformative power of technology and fair access to online resources. Digital content makes up a greater portion of the district's basic curriculum all the time and supplemental materials for intervention programs than ever before. This is not presented as a measure to replace teachers, but rather extending the reach of good teachers to all students. In Yakutat, for example, we do not have fiber access, and thus we have only 10 megabits down, and that severely limits our ability to stream content and use higher-end digital content. And personalized learning opportunities should also be considered. We also have limitations in that area. We are one of the schools severely limited by bandwidth, previously referenced. We are regularly forced to pick and choose what we can simultaneously participate in without the risk of saturating our bandwidth. In addition, this also hampers our students' ability to enroll and participate in dual credit opportunities. This is true, as you've heard previously, in many other school communities in Alaska. While we are increasingly proficient at identifying student skill deficiencies, we cannot access many quality online intervention opportunities for our students. It is truly an equity issue because there are simply have and have not districts throughout the state. Some districts can purchase as much as they can afford, and other districts are not able to purchase anything close to what they need. As part of our 2019 joint position statement, as Dr. Parody pointed out, the Alaska Council of School Administrators stands in support of continuing the broadband assistance grant and increasing the level of state-funded bandwidth for schools to a minimum of 25 megabits of download per second, as proposed during the 2018 legislative session. Please pass SB 74 this year, as it will help bridge the gap in providing equitable opportunities for students. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayer, for your testimony. Is there anyone else signed up? Anyone else in the room? Seeing and hearing none, public testimony is now closed. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just looking here at the list of school districts, and I just have a question, I guess, for one of the folks that came in for invited testimony. Of I count 31 school districts here that have less than 25 megabits per second, and just so, one.
Senator Wilson, why don't we ask Ms. Patience Fredrickson, if you're still here, could you please approach the table? And Senator Wilson, then you can ask Patience your question. Senator Wilson.
Thank you. Just counting here, so we have about 20 school districts that aren't listed here. Are all those 20 school districts, all of their schools are above the 10 megabyte, the above 25 megabytes per school?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, yes, indeed. Every year when we send out the grant application, we send it out to every superintendent, and then those who have schools that are under 10 megabits will submit an application, and those that don't will not. So this is what we think are the total number of schools that are under 10 megabits per second when we did the grant application.
Senator Wilson.
This is a follow-up. So if the schools, let's say the school district didn't turn back in the application or non-responsive, or do you follow up with them or just double-check? Because I was passing up to my colleague here to my left, because I didn't see one of his large school districts from the Lower Yukon School District, and I know that, I don't know if all their schools in a very remote area out in Western Alaska, I just didn't know if they were under. I know for sure they have at least one school that's not meeting this requirement.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, if you're talking specifically about the Lower Kuskokwim School District,
Lower Yukon.
Lower Yukon. We did have one school in another district where there was just one school, and they were going to get a total of $182 school bag grant. And when we sent them the award, they chose not to accept it. I don't know if that's the situation in Lower Yukon. I just do not know for that individual school why they would not apply and receive the funding. It could be simply because the amount was so low that it made no sense to go forward with it.
Senator Wilson, you have.
Well, I don't think, speaking on, since the Lower Yukon School District is in my district, it extends all the way from Hooper Bay all the way up to Russian Mission in that area, and so I would find it highly unlikely that it's one of those schools that doesn't need it. I'm sure it does.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering on Port Alexander, Southeast District, if that's a typo or they're actually at three. And three would be the award winner for the smallest numeric as far as speeds go.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I actually do not have this handout in front of me, so I can't, it's hard for me to reply to that.
Okay. Just maybe we could have her get back just to make sure we don't have a typo. I see up in the Kodiak District, there's a Carluck, and they're at five. So we have just a real small handful of schools that are, and Tenakee Springs is 4.5. Those numbers are pretty low.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I can tell you that over the years of this program, if a school wanted to go from one number to another, but it was still under 10, then we awarded them assistance. And sometimes they simply choose not to go for 10. So in some cases, the school is self-selecting a smaller amount of the internet, but we did give them funding to get them from like 5 to 8. We felt that that was the intent of the program, is to help get them as close to 10, if not to 10. And so that might be the case. Those are fairly small schools that I believe you're talking about.
Okay, thank you.
So I think it's important to understand that the program that we're looking at here is an annual program, and it's more for operating costs versus infrastructure. The important piece, though, is the infrastructure to go beyond 25. I think, though, what might be helpful is when you can, with the list of 172 schools, if you could provide us what's the number of students in each of those schools, I think it might be nice to see a map of where all those schools are, just to give us a dot of the map. And then if you could overlay that where the broadband fiber optic cable has been laid here in Alaska, if you don't have that already, so we can see where some of our schools and how close they are to Angoon. Are we talking 3 or 4 miles away? Are we talking 300 or 400 yards away? And I'm almost done here. I think that it's one thing to provide school districts to go from 10 to 25, which is definitely helpful, but what's our long-term plan?
Chair Von Imhoff, the FCC list that we got, that we developed the 172 schools from, it tells us what type of internet access they're asking for, satellite or otherwise. And I don't know if that would be more, you know, if we gave you that list and indicated how they were getting internet, that would at least allow you to know which ones are on fiber optic and which ones are not. So we could do that.
That would be helpful. I'm just making the naive assumption that if you're on fiber optic cable, you will probably exceed 25 megabits. That's just my guess. So, you know, microwave versus satellite versus, I don't know, handheld transistor radio. I don't know. So I think that it would be nice just to have the list of the 172 schools to what I discussed earlier. Are there any further questions from committee members? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Fredrickson, why would a school not request the maximum amount of internet capability that they'd have available?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, it could simply be a matter of local funding. Since they are paying a portion of the cost, they may say, we're not fully invested in internet education opportunities. They may simply not have the budget to support it.
No further questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Wilson.
And just as a follow-up to that, then, I know that superintendents sometimes go in and out. This is a yearly program, so school districts, let's say if they have a change and come into other federal funding and would like to apply for the program because they can upgrade their infrastructure, would they be then eligible to apply, let's say, in FY 21-22? Or let me rephrase my question. This is going to be a one-time application for the 172 schools that are currently listed today. Would there be another opportunity, or would this need to come up again as a new bill to have other schools that may have missed out on this opportunity due to just lack of infrastructure or lack of equipment or just poor planning on someone's behalf? I just didn't want to make sure that
through the chair, Senator Wilson, as an annual program, we do send the notice out to all the superintendents. So if they missed out on the first year of the program, they would certainly be able to apply for the second year of the program.
Thank you.
So I guess just to build upon that, it's a one and done year, meaning if you are 125 megabits for 1 year and you don't re-up, you don't apply, a superintendent doesn't apply the next year, you go back down to your 2 or 3 or 4, whatever it was you were before?
That's correct. It's an annual application process. It's not very onerous. It's an Excel spreadsheet listing the schools, their costs, a certification form from the superintendent, and some documentation from their internet provider as to the cost.
So I guess as part of just my last question, what the long-term plan is, if we want a goal to have everybody have maintained 25 or above, what would it take to have everybody maintain 25 or above? And I don't know if that's too big of a nut to crack, but, and you don't have to answer that now, okay? It's something that I think that we'd like to have a follow-up question. If this is an annual cost, that's one thing. But it's another thing to bring districts up and keep them there for the long term so they can invest in robust communication and with other school districts, in curriculum, et cetera. So I know it's a big question, and again, you don't have to answer it right now.
Senator Von Imhoff, can I clarify a mistake I made in my earlier testimony?
Yep.
Brittany Hartman talked to me out in the hallway and said, you made a mistake on your testimony. We revised this fiscal note and on Friday, and the 7.169.4 is the cost to get the 172 schools from 10 to 25. And this is in the narrative on page 2 of this. We would also need an annual appropriation of 1.5 to pay for the 1 to 10 megabits per second. So I was mistaken on my previous testimony, and I apologize for that confusion.
Thank you for the clarification, and I really appreciate that. Do we have any other questions from committee members? Okay, we're going to set aside Senate Bill 74 for further review. Please let my office know as soon as possible if you have any concerns or amendments. So that concludes this morning's meeting. Our next meeting will be this afternoon at 1:30 p.m. We will be taking up Senate Bill 32, Crimes, Sentencing, Mental Illness, and Evidence. We are adjourned. Good afternoon. I call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, April 24th, 2019, and the time is 1:34 p.m. We are meeting in the Senate Finance Room of the State Capitol. Silence your cell phones. This is Co-Chair Natasha Von Imhoff. I'm joined today by Co-Chair Stedman, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski. Senator Schauer and Senator Hoffman are excused, and Senator Marchicki is doing other state business. We also have Majority Leader Costello and President Giesel joining us as well. We do have a quorum to do business. Our only agenda item this afternoon is CS for Senate Bill number 32, an act relating to criminal law and procedure, relating to electronic monitoring, relating to controlled substances, relating to probation, relating to driving while license canceled, relating to arrest, relating to sentencing, relating to sentencing for driving under the influence and refusal, relating to reports of involuntary commitment, amending Rule 6R6, Alaska Rules of Criminal Procedure, and providing for an effective date. Our intent is to get an overview of the bill today. We will not be taking public testimony at this meeting. Mr. John Skidmore, Director, Criminal Division, Department of Law, will start with a presentation, then present the details of the bill. Mr. Skidmore, please come to the table, introduce yourself for the record, and begin when you're ready.
Good Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. My name is John Skidmore. I'm the director of the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. We're here to talk about SB 32 and to assist in understanding some of the concepts within 32. I'm going to begin with this overview or presentation. It's called a look back on criminal justice reform. And the things that I wanted to talk about to start us off are sort of what the goals of reform efforts were, and so we have an understanding of how close we are to achieving those goals. And so I go back to the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission's annual report from 2015, and what they told us at that time was that the legislative interest in these efforts, meaning criminal justice reform, were heightened by reports that the Alaska prison population was up by 27% over the last decade, growing at a rate of 3% a year, and that recidivism remained high, nearly 2 out of 3 offenders returning to prison or jail within the 3 years. And that absent further reforms, it was projected the number of persons incarcerated would soon exceed the hard bed capacity. We had just built Goose Creek back then, as you all may remember, and the concern was having to build another prison. So really, this statement summarizes that those goals were, one, to reduce the prison population, and two, to reduce recidivism. I'd like to address each one of those individually. If we start with projected prison population on this next slide, this is a slide that was developed by the Pew Charitable Trusts. They had been asked to help the state of Alaska in looking at what we were faced with. And they said that these numbers were based on numbers that they received from the Department of Corrections. And what this slide indicates to us is that the Alaska criminal justice reform was expected to cut prison population by about 13%. And the number of inmates that had been projected to rise was by 27%. What I'd like to draw your attention to on this slide, however, is this. Where you see the gray start, it's dated on July 1 of 2016. Prior to that, if you look at that trend, which is listed as historical, you will see the continued increase in the prison population. That's what the legislature was told. That is what was published in reports by the Criminal Justice Commission. And this particular slide can actually still be found in Pew's reports all over the internet today. So let's talk about what actually happened with our prison population. This, also from an Alaska's Criminal Justice Commission report, only dated 2018, shows us our prison populations. What I'd like to draw your attention to is, again, go back to 2014, 15, and 16. In the previous slide, if we go back, you'll note that it continues to show our prison population increasing until such time as we institute criminal justice reforms. Without these reforms, our population in prison will increase. That's what we were all told. Look at the actual numbers. It doesn't increase. It decreases. It decreases substantially prior to SB 91's passage, which is marked on this slide. Again, this chart is not mine. This is taken directly from the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission's report. They show us where SB 91 is. And after SB 91 is passed, go back to that previous slide, do you see that precipitous drop in our criminal justice prison population that's supposed to happen after SB 91? And look at what happens. Not only does it not go down substantially, it starts to go back up prior to SB 54, which is where we tried to adjust some of the reforms that were made. So the projections that the legislature was provided that explained what was supposed to happen with our reform efforts simply are not the way things happen. Let's turn our attention to that next goal, that goal of recidivism. In this goal of recidivism, again, we look to the Criminal Justice Commission's report, this one 2016, their annual report found on page 3. And it tells us that the state's growing prison population, which we just discussed, and the increased correction spending, however, has not produced commensurate improvements in public safety outcomes. Nearly 2 out of 3 people released from Alaska prisons return within 3 years. I don't know how many of you were here or remember the debate during SB 91, but one of the refrains that we frequently heard was that our recidivism rate was abominable. I am not here to suggest that our recidivism rate is good. But what we were told is that ours was worse than others in the country, and that we really needed to make changes to fall in line with what other states had been able to achieve. So let's talk about that. The U.S. Department of Justice.
Mr. Skidmore, we're just going to pause just for a moment just for questions at this point. And so I see Senator Stedman has some questions.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. I just had to jump off the table here for a minute, so I wasn't coughing in the mic and grab some water, but so I'm a little late on the question. But on slide 3 and slide 4, slide 3 you were saying was an inaccurate depiction of the population, prison population, historically, relative to the next slide, slide number 4. Slide number 3 being made by the Alaska Department of Corrections is a source document, and the source document on slide 4 is the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission 2018 annual report. So why is there a discrepancy in the numerics? It should be pretty easy to count how many people are in our prisons and not in our prisons, I would think.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, the first slide, slide number 3 that you referred to, that's actually a chart that was created by the Pew Trust, not by anyone in the state of Alaska. The Pew Trust created that chart, not the Department of Corrections, not the Criminal Justice Commission, Pew Trusts. That's what they used, that's what they gave to us, that's what was presented in various committees that I saw when SB 91 was being considered. The data that they say they created the chart from, they say they received from the Department of Corrections. If you go to that next slide, slide 4, this is a chart that is placed in and published by the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission in 2018. That data comes from the Department of Corrections, and the Department of Corrections did help present this slide. They didn't just provide data to somebody, they helped create the slide, as opposed to the last one where Pew created it based on data provided to them.
Madam Chairman, it just seems odd that we could have committee hearings and presentations from the Pew Charitable Trust depicting something that is obviously inaccurate, and the Criminal Justice Commission either wouldn't pick it up or one of the legislatures wouldn't think to go back and compare it to the Criminal Justice Commission's other reports, or it just seems a little odd.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Looking at slide number 4, a couple of years ago, our former Attorney General testified that I believe the number was 5,000 or 7,000 criminals were set free because we didn't have the resources to prosecute them. Do you recall that testimony, number one? And number two, do you think that had an impact on the declining prison populations?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I believe the testimony that was provided in prior years said that the number of cases that were being prosecuted had fallen. Not that we weren't necessarily prosecuting a particular person, but the number of cases we were prosecuting fell. In terms of how that has an impact on the prison population, I certainly think it's possible that that has an impact, but I can't tell you precisely what caused it. The point of these slides in my presentation wasn't to discuss causes so much as it was to discuss the fact that there is a drastic difference between what was presented to the legislature and what actually occurred. What was most troubling to me is you'll note that the slide 3, this one's actually showing you the historic trend going to 2016, meaning this is supposed to represent the numbers for 15 and 16. And yet, when you look at slide 4, the numbers for 15 and 16 are definitely different. That's not talking about why the population went down, just the fact that it did.
Senator Wilikowski, follow up.
Right, but if there were 5,000 fewer criminals being prosecuted because we lacked the resources to prosecute them, that would result in a decline in the prison population. Isn't that right?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I believe that not being able to prosecute folks for lack of resources does have the potential to have an impact. I don't ever recall the number being 5,000. I do recall there being a number that we weren't able to address.
So, thank you. I think that the purpose, again, of this bill is to take a look at what reform is needed to give law enforcement officials the tools that they need to effectively address lowering numbers of repeat criminals, recidivism, as well as just the amount of crime on the street. So there is a little bit of history that is required to kind of bring us up to speed, but that is not the meat and potatoes of this bill. We need to really understand the sentencing changes that you are recommending. So please proceed.
Thank you. We were talking about the goal of recidivism and the goal of recidivism that we wanted to bring it down, and the slide that we had left off on was slide number 6, which talked about the national recidivism rate. This was a study that was done by the U.S. Department of Justice in 2018, looking at those individuals released in 2005, following them through the year of 2014. The things to note about the study is that it actually was a composite of 30 different states and their releases of inmates. It was prisoners, as I already indicated, released in 2005, and it followed them for those 9 years. This is a map that shows you all of the states that were actually covered by that recidivism study. You'll note that Alaska is one of those states that was covered. The other thing that I wanted to point out is some of the other states that were covered as well. You'll see Utah, Georgia, North Carolina, Texas, Oregon, South Dakota. Those are all on there as well. I mention that. It's significant because the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission's report from December of 2015 on page 5, when it talks about the goals of the changes that are being recommended to our state laws, refers to those other states that I just named, Utah, Georgia, North Carolina, Texas, Oregon, South Dakota. And in fact, it calls out Georgia to say that Georgia, after implementing these reforms, had a 3% decrease in their crime rate. We'll come back to that because right now we're just on recidivism. What recidivism means, according to the study, and this is important to understand the changes that we're going to talk about in the bill, SB 32, is that first you have to start with an event such as the release from prison. Where does the clock start? Second, you have to ask yourself, what are you counting? Arrests? Convictions? What is it that you're going to count? A return to prison? And then finally, you have to decide how long you're going to count them. And the options are from 6 months all the way up to 9 years, which is what this particular study did. The National Recidivism, they looked at over 400,000 state prisoners released in 2005. And for them, they tracked how many arrests there were over a 9-year period, an average of 5 arrests per released prisoner. That doesn't mean that every prisoner recidivated. What it does mean is that some prisoners are recidivating multiple times. The national average, according to this study, over 400,000 inmates from 30 states, the national average was 68%. You'll recall we were told that our rate was somewhere around 2/3. The other thing that I wanted to point out from this study, and I would encourage folks to go and look at the study itself, it's very enlightening, it's approximately 24 pages long. But one of the other highlights from it was that more than 3/4, 77% of released drug offenders were arrested for a non-drug crime in 9 years. We want to talk about crime rates in Alaska. We want to talk about what's going wrong. We're going to be talking about drug crimes in SB 32. But what I want to point out is people keep asking for data. People keep saying, where's the data to support these various things? What this is telling us is that our drug offenders that are out there in such a large percentage of prisoners released across the country, this is proof positive that those individuals are engaging in significant other types of crime. That's the significance of this. Keep that in mind when we come and talk about reforms to drug crimes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Mr. Skidmore, and what's the cause of the repeat offenses by these drug offenders, do we know?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, the study that I read, this 2018 report, didn't describe the causes. It just said this is what's happening with recidivism.
Thank you.
So we talked about national recidivism. Let's talk about Alaska's recidivism. The slide you have in front of you now is labeled Alaska Recidivism and Reentry, February 15th of 2019. This is actually a presentation that was made in the Finance Committee of the other body just earlier this year by the Department of Corrections. Recidivism, you'll note that their definition of recidivism says the amount of time that we're going to monitor somebody is 3 years. 3 years was the same amount of time that 68% average was listed from the earlier slide in the national study. And it says we're going to look at, measure what? Probation parole violations, new felony crimes, and new misdemeanor crimes. So we know that it's compared to what that national study was looking at. And what did they find? Well, we went back to 2011 in this particular presentation by the Department of Corrections. And at that time, they show the recidivism rate in Alaska is about 67.5%. So it's right around that 2/3 that we heard about from the testimony provided for SB 91. What's of note, however, on this slide is that you go from 2011 to 2012 and that recidivism rate drops. It ticks up slightly in 2013, but then in 14, it drops again, and in 15, it drops significantly more. 2015, criminal justice reform in SB 91 was passed July of 2016. So we were told, in order to lower our prison population, in order to lower our recidivism rate, these reforms were needed. You can break down the recidivism in Alaska slightly more than that. You can actually look at it in the first 6 months, and they show you that over 50% of those people recidivating are for probation and parole violations. But when you get to the three-year mark, it more than 50% is the new crimes. This is interesting information and could help us say, where would we need to focus our efforts if we wanted to reduce recidivism? But let's talk about recidivism for new crime.
Hold on. We have Senator Wilson who just raised his hand.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gilmore, do you know when the DOC started doing their inpatient treatment programs in the prison systems?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilson, I don't have that information. There is somebody from DOC here, if that's a question that you wanted them to answer, though.
Okay, that can wait till later, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Well, while we're on this slide, technical violations, I mean, that's 58% and even 46% after 3 years, technical probation violations. What does that mean?
What that means is that someone is sentenced and placed on probation, and that the probation violation, the conditions that are set for while they are on probation, have been violated. That person has returned to prison, and that violation was something other than committing a new crime.
Okay. I mean, did Senate Bill 91 address that? That seems to be quite a bit of people. I mean, what are the numbers of people? When you take 58% of those who return to custody, so how many numbers of people? I mean, that's more than half due to a technical violation. Does this bill address that, or does any bill address that? Do we have to address that?
To the Chair, that's an excellent question. I'm glad you've asked it. SB 32 does not address probation and parole, but SB 34 does. That's a bill that should be in this committee soon, and I look forward to talking with you more about that when it comes up.
Thank you very much.
The recidivism is the next slide, and that's slide 14. This is one that is showing the recidivism just for the new crimes. We saw the percentages that are there, but let's talk about the recidivism rate just in new crimes alone. In 2011, you saw it was slightly over 40%, but by 2015, it's all the way down to 32%. Again, we were told that without reforms, we couldn't reduce our recidivism rate, that our recidivism rate was at two-thirds. If you're looking at new crimes, the data prior to the implementation of any of those reforms says that we were making changes in our recidivism rate. We were bringing down our prison population. That's the significant thing. So the next slide just says, look, there was a 6% decline in Alaska's recidivism rate from 2011 to 2015, and that place that we ended up in 2015 was 7% below the national average found for those people released from 2005. Thus, we were doing better than the national average. That's not what we were originally told when folks were examining SB 91. Now, I want to talk about crime rates. And you have a slide in front of you that depicts crime rates from those other states. There's two things that I'd like to point out before we begin this. The first, I go back to page 5 of the Justice Reinvestment Report released by the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission in December of 2015. They say the states that have used justice reinvestment strategies were, and I quote, Georgia, Mississippi, North Carolina, Oregon, South Dakota, Texas, and Utah, among many others, have implemented reforms to protect public safety and control corrections costs. The next paragraph on that same page 5 talks about in 2011, Georgia was faced with this substantial problem in terms of the cost of their prisons. And what they did is that they passed reforms. I quote, changes to drug and property offense statutes and improved public safety by investing in drug and mental health courts and treatment. Between 2012 and 2014, the most recent year with available crime data, the state rate, this referring to Georgia, crime rate has fallen by 3%. I read this directly from their report because I've heard some say that we shouldn't be paying attention to crime rates when we're looking at whether or not these particular reforms worked. I don't know why not. The Criminal Justice Commission itself looked at crime rates and used that as a metric to measure whether or not reforms were working. If they did it, it only makes sense for the rest of us to do it. So let's look at those states that they referred to in their report that they said they wanted us to model after. Those are the ones that are found on the slide in front of you.
So I am looking here. Okay, sorry, I thought you were going to switch to the next slide. Keep going. I apologize.
So on the slide that we have in front of us, let's look at those other states. You have Georgia. You have Kentucky. Kentucky's the only one not listed on page 5, and I'll explain why it's included. North Carolina, Oregon, South Dakota, Texas, Utah, those were all the states that were specifically called out to us that we should be looking at. So we went back to look at their crime rates. We took their crime rates from the year 2000 and took them all the way through 2017. In addition, we included Kentucky. Why Kentucky? Because Kentucky was the state that we looked to for pretrial reforms in terms of bail. So we wanted to compare what Kentucky had done as well. And then finally, on the same slide, we've also thrown in there the United States rate. That's the one represented in black. Alaska, we represented in red. The slide shows you two different rates, property crime and violent crime. Violent crime is represented at the top. For each of those states, they are represented by a different color line going across the graph. And you'll see a star along that line. That star indicates the year in which that state engaged in their criminal justice reform efforts. Now, a couple things that I would point out. Almost across the board, not entirely, but almost across the board, after engaging in criminal justice reform, crime rates for these states went down, both for property and for violent crimes. Aside from Alaska, the exception is South Dakota, which is represented by the brown line. And in the upper graph, you'll see they engaged in criminal justice reform in 2013, and their violent crime rate did tick up at that time. Whether that's the result of the criminal justice reforms or whether that's the result of increased population from other economic activity in their states at the time, I don't have those sorts of answers for you. That's not the point of these slides. The point of the slides is you go back to what the Criminal Justice Commission said and what the Pew Trusts told us, that engaging in these reforms would help us remain safe in our state, that we were not going to be seeing greater public safety concerns. And when you look at the charts, yes, our crime rate began to tick up before criminal justice reform occurred. There is no question that that occurred. But after the criminal justice reform occurred, our crime rates continued to tick up. So I've heard some people say, why in the world would we want to go back to what we had before when it wasn't working? I'd like to turn to the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission's report from 2018. This is not a slide that you all have. This is just a quote I'd like to read you. This was published on November 1 of 2018. It's on page 40 of that report. It reads, and I quote, "Research into the nationwide decline in crime rates over the last 30 years shows that between 10 and 25% of the decline of crime was attributable to the effect of increased incarceration rates." Let me read that again. "The research into nationwide decline in crime rates over the last 30 years shows that between 10 and 25% of the decrease is attributable to increased incarceration rates." Now, it is true, this report goes on to say those returns become diminishing around 2015, and I acknowledge that. The continued increasing of incarceration rates was not yielding the same sort of benefit. But it is well settled and cited by the Criminal Justice Commission that increase in incarceration rates did work for 30 years. And our criminal justice rates support that. Go back and look at them for the last 30 years. We did drive crime down by doing that. So it begs this question: what should we be doing to try and help the uptick that we saw in 2015?
So, Mr. Skidmore, I think that you have an audience here that wants to do something with crime. I don't think that you need to convince us that we have issues or that SB 91 has its flaws or anything along that matter. And while I appreciate the historical context, really, we just need to understand what's in the bill. And we need to understand what it is that you're recommending that we do and the pros and cons of it. And, you know, we're with you, okay?
I appreciate that, Senator. My presentation is both for you all and for others that may be listening. I'm constantly reminded that we have public listening to these hearings, and I want them to understand of where we're going and all of this.
I appreciate that, but this is the third committee of referral. Have you done this presentation two times before?
No, ma'am.
This is your first presentation.
On this bill? Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Did I see a hand up? Senator Bishop.
Thank you. I don't want an answer now, but I'd like you to consider when you're done here with this bill and wrap up, I would love to hear a solution besides locking more people up. I have no problem doing that, but I just got to say this. I was in a country that's got 122 people locked up, and they had a problem 30 years ago, and they corrected the problem. So I'd like to see a fix idea coming from the administration, too, going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Through the chair, I agree with you, and I appreciate the comments from the chair as well. This is driving to the point of what we're doing in the bill and why we do it in the bill. I realize to you it feels historical, but it's explaining why we're going to do what we do. The slide 17 is just a comparison of those states when they engaged in criminal justice reform, showing you what sort of reforms various states engaged in. This chart is actually a chart that the Pew Foundation put out. The colors and highlighting are things that we added to it just to help you see where the reforms were done. The other thing that I want to talk about just briefly is there's also a lot of discussion between violent and nonviolent crimes and those crime rates. I want to make sure that everybody's on the same page about what the difference in those are. Violent crime in the state of Alaska is defined as something found in Alaska Statute 1141, and I list those types of crimes there. Nonviolent is everything else. I give some samples of those crimes, and on the next slide, you also need to remember that nonviolent crime includes all of these other types of crimes that, to most of us, we wouldn't necessarily think that was nonviolent. That's significant, again, because we're going to talk about sentencing all across the board in SB 32. We then come back to those crime rates, just because I wanted to remind you of what they looked like as we address this question, why did crime rise before SB 91? This goes to the heart of what we're trying to accomplish in SB 32. You will see that the opioid overdose deaths increased throughout this time. This was when we had the drug epidemic. And the second graph on there, which shows you 16 to 17, shows you that inpatient treatment for opioids went down from 16 to 17, while our emergency care went up. We had fewer people getting drug treatment in residential treatment programs and more emergency care after SB 91 was passed. How do we go about fixing those things? This is where we get to what I know you all are interested in, which is the overview of 32. And I will tell you that one of the main things we're going to be discussing in 32 is returning our drug laws to where they were before. I recognize and I hear the question that simply returning them and locking them up isn't what we want to be doing. That's not what we're proposing. So if we turn to 32 and we talk about Section 1, Section 1 returns our drug laws to pre-SB 91 as it relates to the homicide statutes. That's the sections 1 and 2 that you find there. There are provisions that talk about drug crimes and the homicide statutes, and this just returns it to those things. Sections 3 through 18 eliminate inflation proofing that was found in SB 91. Thank you. This is really talking about the public needing to be involved in adjusting the felony threshold for property crimes. We saw this play out in SB 64, in SB 91, in SB 54, in all of those bills in varying years. The public was very interested and engaged at where we set that threshold amount. And the reason that this is removing the inflation adjustment is so that that debate can appropriately occur here in the legislature, as well as some of the constitutional issues that we found when we reviewed SB 91 originally in the bill review letter. Section 19 changes escape by creating, by adding the Department of Health and Social Services to escape in the second degree, which is a B felony. Currently in law, it only includes the Department of Corrections. It does not include those juvenile facilities for someone that walks away or escapes from those facilities. So this adds them to that particular statute. Then in Section 20, what you have is tampering with an electronic monitoring device or walking away from a CRC. What it does is it says if you have an electronic monitoring device on for a misdemeanor offense, then that would be a C felony if you remove it. If you have an electronic monitoring device on while on bail and remove it, that would be a C felony. If you walk away from a CRC or a halfway house, that would be a misdemeanor. It's trying to address some of those public safety concerns. Sections 21 and 22 deal with failure to appear. It returns failure to appear to where it was prior to SB 91. What we know thus far is that our failure to appear prosecutions after we passed SB 91 plummeted substantially. That is, we were no longer requiring people to show up in court and holding them accountable through prosecutions. It simply wasn't possible with the changes. That's a concern when you want to hold offenders accountable. Section 23 deals with violation of conditions of release, and it returns violation of conditions of release to the levels that they were prior to SB 91. That is a Class A misdemeanor if somebody was on conditions of release for a felony, and a Class B misdemeanor if they were on violation of conditions of release for a misdemeanor. The reason that this is important is while the 5 days that was increased, SB 91 passed and there was no jail time associated with these, it was a violation. SB 54 passed, we changed it back to a crime but limited it to 5 days. We thought that would solve the problem. As it turns out, we were mistaken in that it hasn't. We've gone back and looked at other cases, and there's one particular case that I remember because, well, it was a case that I prosecuted. And in this particular case, it was a gentleman who had set his wife on fire. He was released from jail. He was told not to have any contact with her. He did. He was arrested. He was put back in jail. He was released from jail a second time. Would you be surprised to know that he had contact with his wife yet again? And when it came time to that trial, to have his wife testify against him, we literally had to escort her to the courthouse because she didn't want to be there. She was so afraid of him, and she was so convinced that the system could do nothing to protect her because he was continually released and was not held in jail. Our hope with just 5 days was that we would be able to hold someone in jail. Now, the case I'm describing to you occurred prior to SB 91. It was not impacted by SB 91. I want to be clear about that. I use it as an example to say when someone violates their conditions of release, getting the bail adjusted sometimes is not enough. We need to be able to convict that person. We convicted this gentleman of both of those crimes so that by the time his trial did come around for setting his wife on fire, he was in jail. That was instrumental in actually getting her to the courthouse. So changing this is substantial, is significant for public safety concerns.
So Mr. Skidmore, just on that note then, are you changing, is this bill changing it to be pre-91, or are you doing a little added special sauce to so we could get a gentleman like that the first time and not the third time?
No added special sauce, Madam Chair. This is simply returning us to pre-SB 91 law.
Is that sufficient, in your opinion, to get to address issues like the one you just described?
Yes, I believe it is, Madam Chair.
If I asked that same question to the wife, would she answer it the same way?
If you ask that same question to the wife, I doubt she would respond to you, Madam. She refuses to talk to people. She was a non-cooperative witness, and we actually had to prosecute him by all the statements that she made to family members and to hospital folks and to first responders, because by the time he was out of jail and had contacted her, being released on that first time, she was no longer willing to cooperate and refused to cooperate throughout the trial and beyond. So is it sufficient? If the legislature were to determine they wanted to increase that, that's certainly within your purview to do that. You're asking me, do I think this is sufficient to try to achieve those goals? My answer is yes. But if you disagree with me, you all certainly have the ability to increase it higher if you chose to do so. Thank you. Section 24, then, if I may. Section 24 talks about terroristic threatening. Currently, terroristic threatening in our state requires that the threat be a false threat, i.e., I threaten to blow up a movie theater, but when I make that threat, I don't actually intend to do it. Well, what if I called in the threat and I did intend to do it, but they intervened before that? Would you believe that that's not actually considered a crime in our state? So what this bill does is it changes it to include that threat, even when it's not false, and it requires that based upon that threat, there was some sort of emergency response. There was an evacuation of the building. There was some other emergency response that was involved with it to ensure that it's at a serious enough level that we are actually prepared to criminalize the conduct. That's terroristic threatening.
Mr. Skidmore?
Yes, ma'am.
Is this for people over age 18? And the reason why I say this is, do you recall earlier this year when several of our high schools in Anchorage had to be evacuated? How do we handle that for people under age of 18?
Madam Chair, I have two daughters in those high schools, in those schools in Anchorage, so I do remember that incident. And what I can tell you is that this law applies to all citizens. We would deal with anyone over the age of 18 in the adult criminal justice system, and anyone under the age of 18 would be dealt with in the juvenile criminal justice system, but this law would apply to them as well. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for the clarification, and I do want to recognize that Senator Hughes is with us.
I'm going to move on then to Section 25. Section 25 talks about disorderly conduct. It returns the penalty for disorderly conduct from merely 24 hours to 10 days. And then we get to Section 26 and 27 and 28 and 29, 30, 31, and 32. I mention them all together as a group. I'm going to go through them individually for you all. I mention them as a group because you'll see the vast majority of the sections in the bill. Let me rephrase that. The largest section of the bill that it deals with one thing is the drug offenses. I spent so much time in that preview because I wanted to talk about drug offenses, and I wanted you to understand why these changes to drug offenses are going to be made. This is where I hope it will all be tied together for you all today. Section 26 talks about a crime called misconduct involving controlled substances in the second degree. And what this does is it returns the distribution or the trafficking in Schedule 1A drugs. Schedule 1A drugs are heroin, fentanyl, methadone. It returns the trafficking of those types of drugs from a B or a C felony where they are currently back to an A felony. It also eliminates a tiered approach based on weight that was introduced in SB 91 and returns us back to any possession that allows us to then adjust the sentences appropriately through various factors and aggravators or mitigators that are found in our statutes and in our case law that were there prior to SB 91, have remained in there since, are still in there today. And the reason that that's significant is because when you try and say there's a particular weight or a particular amount of a drug and that's what we're going to say is the difference, that doesn't take into things of consideration like heroin and fentanyl. They're both Schedule 1A drugs. Did you know that fentanyl is 100 times more powerful than heroin? And yet we're treating the quantity of both fentanyl and heroin exactly the same. There needs to be discretion that's given to the courts to be able to address those variances. And there's a case called Knight. It was an appellate case in our state that talked about the importance of being able to evaluate drugs in terms of the purity of the drugs, in terms of the community that they are in, the value of the drug in that particular community, the degree of the epidemic in that community. Kodiak is one of those places that we have a tremendous drug problem at the moment. I don't mean to suggest it's not in other parts of the state, but if you followed the headlines, there have been recent busts at a federal level for a tremendous amount of drugs that were flowing in the community of Kodiak. So in order to properly address them, there needs to be that level of discretion. And returning it to a Class A felony ensures that we are truly addressing those sentencing goals that SB 91 was never focused on. General deterrence, specific deterrence, community condemnation, and yes, even isolation where it's appropriate. It also returns the language about manufacturing methamphetamine. We've heard a lot about how there was an opioid crisis. I don't know how much you all may or may not have heard. Methamphetamine continues to be a drug and a substance that plagues our state today, and ensuring that the manufacture of it remains something that we can aggressively pursue is important to that goal. The next section, Section 27, is misconduct involving controlled substances in the third degree.
One moment. We have a question with Senator Machiki, who has been with us for several minutes now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have for you, Mr. Skidmore, is we hear from people that we just need to provide treatment. Why is it important that we return possession to being a Class C felony? What function does that have? First of all, do we have to lock up someone who is convicted? And does that have any benefit for it being returned to possession being returned to a Class C? Does that have any value in you helping to arrest and prosecute those that are trafficking drugs?
Through the chair, Senator Machiki, you're actually asking me questions that apply to Section 29. I'm happy to answer them now. Section 29 returns possession of illegal drugs to a Class C felony as opposed to the Class A misdemeanor where they are currently. Prior to SB 91, they were classified as a Class C felony as well. And what we would do in those cases is that many of those cases were resolved through plea negotiations where we could either reduce it to a misdemeanor or resolve it in a sentence, resolve it with a sentence that didn't have much jail time, and by that I mean less than 90 days. The problem with that is that individuals continued to have that felony conviction on their record, and felony convictions have collateral consequences. SB 32 does not repeal all of SB 91. There were certainly components of SB 91 that were and remain beneficial today. Let me give you an example because it applies to this very question you've just asked. It's a concept called the suspended entry of judgment, otherwise known as an SEJ. It did not exist prior to SB 91. What an SEJ allows us to do is to negotiate a case so that we can set conditions that someone needs to follow. For example, a person that is convicted of possessing drug crimes, and we say, you need to go to drug treatment. That's a condition that we can place on them. If they successfully complete that treatment, what the SEJ allows us to do that was not previously found in statute is it says that that case is then dismissed without the conviction ever being entered on that person's record. You avoid the collateral consequences associated with a felony conviction. Why? Because you were going to treatment and you successfully completed it. It's a new tool. It's a tool that's important for us to be able to utilize because we don't simply want to be punishing people for being addicted to drugs. What we want to do is return our statutes to a place where we can aggressively pursue those trafficking in drugs, what successfully worked for 30 years. We want to continue to be able to do that. But when it comes to drug possession, we want to be in a position where we can incentivize treatment. One of the slides that I gave you, in fact, it was the last slide I gave you in the overview that began. We looked at what's happened with hospitalization between 16 and 17 related to opioids. It showed you that long-term hospitalization went down. That treatment, residential treatment, went down. We weren't doing a better job at getting people into treatment. And what we saw instead was a spike in what? Emergency treatment. Someone overdoses and has to go to the emergency room. That's not solving the problem for us. We need to incentivize people to go and seek that treatment. I'll tell you something maybe a lot of people don't know. In my family, we have people that are addicted to substances, and we would have to do interventions with those people to get them to treatment. While I would hope most families would engage in that, sometimes those interventions don't work. The family's not enough. And the role that the criminal justice system plays is to encourage people to go to that treatment. I am in no way saying through SB 32, nor is the administration saying in SB 32, that all we want to do is lock people up. Senator Bishop's question. That's not what we're interested in doing. This is a first step in what we need to do. But that first step recognizes that to truly combat the drug crisis that our state faces, it is a multi-pronged approach, a multifaceted approach. And yes, the criminal justice system is one of those prongs, is one of those facets. It does play a role. To eliminate it the way that we did at the same time that the drug epidemic happened, I would submit to you that had a large amount to do with the increase that we saw in our crime rates. We truly want to get a handle on that again? Let us aggressively go after the people that are dealing drugs
And let us try to incentivize people that are abusing drugs to get into treatment.
So I appreciate all of these, and to have the stories and examples are actually important and helpful to help us understand each of the sections and how you arrived in this bill. But we also, it's a very large bill, and we want to be able to get through it. And just on a side note, we invited Department of Corrections, Department of Health and Social Services, and Department of Safety to come in here and talk about the opioid epidemic earlier in the session to try to provide a vision of how to address that very thing that you're talking about. So you are, again, the fourth leg of the stool here in the criminal and law. So I'm going to have Senator Wilson followed by Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Skidmore, I don't disagree on your last slide and your comments upon, the opioid and drug epidemics have helped led to the drug crisis as well, but some of the behavioral health decrease was also due to our expansion services, the grant cuts, funding, and we also had a sort of an economic issue within our state as well. Those that have less, that sometimes take more. That also occurs. So there's a lot of external factors that have helped raise a crime that's more than just the drug epidemic issue, which we do have in our state, but there's other factors that also led to increase in our crime rate as well. And I just wanted to put that as just not solving that issue, but we did have an economic issue within our state. I think 16 is also the year, I can make the same correlation that, our PFDs may have raised the crime rates as well. So I'm just saying that I just don't want folks to just focus just on the one issue of just the drugs, but there's multiple facets to our crime issue as well.
I appreciate that, Senator Wilson, through the chair, and I 100% agree with what you're saying. I'm not suggesting that it's all about the drugs. I agree all those other factors that you mentioned do play a role in it. All I'm saying is being able to combat the drug crisis in this way is one of the pieces that's needed. It's not the only thing that's going to turn it around. That would be foolish to say that, but it is one of the pieces that's needed.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski had a question.
Thank you. What percentage of drug possession defendants are given a suspended entry of judgment?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, currently that percentage I would imagine is extremely low. I don't have a number with me today, but let me tell you this. I can give you the number today about what happened with our drug prosecutions. Prior to SB 91, we were prosecuting around 1,000 of them a year. Now we're prosecuting somewhere around 320. So it was a substantial drop in drug prosecutions as the result of SB 91. That's part of what we're also trying to get back to, is to say we know there are more drug crimes out there. We need to overcome what I would describe as a systematic inertia, if you will. Right now, when the crime carries very little penalty, if any, there just isn't a lot of incentive to spend resources on investigating it and trying to run it through the criminal justice system when there's not a lot of benefit on the other end. So right now, no, there's not a lot of SEJs that are being utilized, but we couldn't incentivize somebody. You're going to say to them, you have to agree to an SEJA, you have to agree to go do treatment to successfully complete the SEJ, and the response from the defendant is, why would I do that? I'm not going to get any jail time if I don't agree to it anyway. Send me all the way through. Take me to trial. At the end of it, the judge isn't authorized to impose any jail time at all. What incentive do I have to go and submit myself to that long-term residential treatment program? The answer is none. So I don't think we're seeing very many of them utilized at the moment for drug possession.
Senator Wilikowski, follow up.
And what is your anticipation if we pass this about how many SEJs we will see?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that's an excellent question. I don't have hard and fast number of how many more crimes we would see presented to us. I believe our estimates are somewhere in the neighborhood of a rise of 700 cases. I would expect a large percentage of those, more than half of them, we would be trying to drive into some sort of residential treatment program. Would an SEJ be appropriate in all of them? I don't know the answer. We'd have to evaluate that on a case-by-case basis. But it's certainly a tool that we have. It's certainly a tool that I intend to tell all of the prosecutors across the state handling these cases, we want to be aggressively using and pursuing.
So I don't know if you've already described this, but what is an SEJ?
Madam Chair, I earlier indicated that an SEJ is something called a suspended entry of judgment. It was created in SB 91. It's different than an SIS, which is a suspended imposition of sentence.
I'm sorry, I apologize. I didn't catch that.
That's okay. If there aren't any other questions, I wanted to return to Section 27 where we left off, which was misconduct involving controlled substances in the third degree. This returns the distributions of Schedule 2A and 3A to a higher classification, that is a B felony. 28 is a conforming section. 29 deals with misconduct involving controlled substance in the fourth. That's the possession crimes that we've just spent a great deal of time discussing, as well as distribution of low-level drugs. Section 30 is a conforming amendment. Section 31 deals with misconduct involving controlled substance in the fifth degree. It's a Class A misdemeanor. It's really talking about much lower-level drugs. I would point out to you that in this section, we have modified it from where we were pre-SB 91 to make it clear that those individuals complying with our marijuana laws are not subject to this prosecution. Only if you were out of compliance with those other laws are you subject to prosecution on marijuana. And the same thing goes with Section 32, which is misconduct involving a controlled substance in the sixth degree, which is the possession of marijuana. This is a crime now that really only applies to people that are 18, 19, or 20 under that 21 age of when it's authorized for use. And again, so a very limited level there. But the protections have been added to those statutes that did not exist pre-91. Section 33 is a conforming amendment.
We're going to pause just because I think that's the end of the drugs, or Section 33, because I think I saw Senator Michicki and Senator Wilikowski, I think, both had questions. So if this is near the ending of the drugs section.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just back to Section 29. So there were a couple comments about drugs not being 100% responsible for the increase, yet we're seeing dramatic increases in opioid overdose deaths in Alaska for the last decade. And I can tell you that there are four parts of my community that are terrorized by drug houses where the tools simply aren't there because of the inability to charge with a crime other than a violation. So the question I have is a simple one. I asked it a minute ago, and I asked a few in a row there, so you missed one. Why would someone arrested of possession turn state's evidence if it's a violation? Would they take the risk of turning in a potentially very dangerous drug dealer if there's no risk to them and all they get is a little violation and go on their way?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, I believe what you're talking about is one of the tools that are used to try and get to drug dealers, which is when law enforcement comes into contact with a someone that's using and abusing drugs. Excuse me. There will oftentimes be discussions about whether or not that individual is willing to cooperate with law enforcement for some benefit from law enforcement. Namely that they either might not be prosecuted or that their sentence would be lower or that even the charge itself could be reduced. To answer your question more precisely, when we come into contact with that individual and the most they're facing is a Class A misdemeanor that has no jail time associated, you're correct. There's very little incentive for them to want to cooperate with law enforcement, which does have an impact on our ability to prosecute other traffickers or higher level crimes.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Section 29, page 19, talks about 25 or more plants of genus cannabis. Who would that apply to?
I'm sorry, you said page 19?
Line 25 or more plants of cannabis.
Yes.
Does that apply to manufacturers or commercial growers, I guess?
The answer to that question is no. I would turn you back to page 18, you will find at the beginning of Section 29, except as authorized in Alaska Statute 0305, that deals with industrial hemp. Alaska Statute AS 1730, that's dealing with pharmacies, and then Alaska Statute 1738, which is recreational marijuana. So in all of those instances where someone is legally authorized to be engaged in the growing or the selling of marijuana, they are protected because this does not apply to them. So the only people this would apply to are those that are outside of those other systems that are now in place in our state for legal marijuana usage and growing.
Senator Wilikowski, follow up.
Thank you. Regarding the recriminalization of the drug possession, do you have any sense of how many additional people that would put in jail?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I don't know that number off the top of my head. We in the Department of Law analyzed the number of people that we thought there would be an increase in prosecutions for. And as you asked me a moment ago, would we expect to see an increase in the use of SEJs and how many people would be covered by that? I told you I expected that to be a substantial number. I don't know the precise number because what you've done beyond that is you've now broken it down to just possession crimes. And that larger number that I gave you of the decrease in 700 in filings deals both with distribution and possession. So I don't, as I sit here today, I don't have numbers to tell you the difference between those. Would there be some increase in people going to jail? I think the answer is yes, but the exact number I'm not able to provide you.
Senator Wilikowski.
What does the research show on the effectiveness of putting people in jail for possession of drugs? How effective has that been nationwide?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I would tell you that if someone was just going to be placed in jail as the only option, I don't believe the research shows that to be very effective. What we have talked about, however, is trying to incentivize them towards treatment. And for those individuals that are refusing to get treatment, they then remain a danger to the public. And it's less about whether or not that's going to help that person avoid future crimes, that is, keep them from recidivating, and more now about general deterrence or isolation, because we know from our recidivism statistics, individuals that commit drug crimes also go out and commit other types of crimes. And if we can't have this person change their behavior by getting into treatment, then we need to be taking a different step, a different path to protecting society. But the underlying premise of your question, is putting somebody in jail an effective way of dealing with their substance abuse? The answer is no, that is not an effective way. So to the extent that you want to deal with that, you need to try this other method first. But if that fails, then you have to say, what then? And that's when we start to talk about jail.
So we have 30 minutes left, and we have several more sections to go through. This is not the last time we're going to see this bill. I would like to have Mr. Skidmore try to get through the sectional to the degree that we can. At the same time, Senator Wilikowski, I understand that you have further questions. Let's try to find a time that perhaps you can meet with Mr. Skidmore, or we can zero in on particular subjects you might want further information in the next time we see the bill. Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Please continue.
Section 33, I believe, is where I left off, which is a conforming amendment for the Good Samaritan Law. It just talks about it's conforming to the changes that we made in the drug statutes. Section 34 then talks about probation links. It returns them to pre-SB 91 probation links, 25 years for sex offenses and 10 years for all the rest. Sections 35 through 37 take presumptive sentencing back to where it was pre-SB 91. Presumptive sentencing, for those who don't know, in our state, when you are sentenced for a felony, we have a tiered approach that says if you've committed felonies in the past in a certain period of time, then your presumptive sentence, the starting place for the court in analyzing a sentence, increases with the more felonies you have. This simply returns it to where it was pre-SB 91. Section 38 deals with sex crimes. It says that you cannot suspend a sentence for a sex crime or to reduce the period of probation. This is, again, pre-SB 91 law. And it also conforms to Section 34 up above. Section 39 talks about Class A misdemeanors. It returns sentencing from, returns it back to pre-SB 91 law of 0 to 1 year. It does not require time to be imposed. It gives the judge discretion up to 1 year. It changes it from the 30-day cap that we currently have in law now. Section 40 talks about B misdemeanors. It returns it to pre-SB 91 of 0 to 90 days that the judge can evaluate as opposed to the 0 to 10 that's in current law. Again, it does not require any jail time to be imposed. It just gives that discretion to the court. Sections 41 and 42 talk about the crime of driving while license suspended, revoked, or canceled. It returns this to a crime. It's currently a violation for most of that conduct, not all of it, but most of it. It returns all of that conduct to a Class A misdemeanor. It does impose some sentencing requirements that go along with it. I would point out those sentencing requirements are not, I repeat, not what was in law pre-SB 91. This is less than where we were pre-SB 91. It does not include required community work services does not require certain fines. It does replicate 10 days with 10 days suspended on a first offense and 10 days of active jail time. Those are exactly what was in the law pre-SB 91. Sections 34 and, sections 43 and 44 address mandatory EM as a sentence for a first DUI. It eliminates EM as the mandatory and returns it to a CRC or electronic monitoring at the discretion of the Department of Corrections Commissioner. This again is pre-SB 91 law. Section 45 is a conforming amendment for drug offenses in the Landlord and Tenant Act. They just reference it in that act, so it's conforming. Section 46 is conforming for DJJ in terms of dealing with drug laws, which takes us to Section 47. 47 looks at Criminal Rule 6. Criminal Rule 6 is the one that applies to grand juries. What Section 47 allows us to do is that when there is a crime to be charged at the grand jury, instead of having to obtain a certified copy of a judgment, we are allowed to rely on a system called APSIN, which is the state's criminal justice database. So for instance, you have a person that is charged with being a felon in possession. We would have to show that that person has a prior felony within a certain period of time. Under current law, we are required to go and get a certified copy of that judgment before we can go to the grand jury. What this would say is you can actually take that conviction from APSIN and use it in the same way that you currently can for, say, felony DUI. It does not change any substantive rights of a defendant. We would still, at trial, need that certified judgment, so it's not changing anything else. This is really just an efficiency. But that's what Section 47 does. Section 48 is repealers. Section 49 deals with involuntary commitment information being provided to the Department of Public Safety from the Alaska court system. This is really about data sharing, nothing more. We're not changing any legal status of anyone. We're not changing any legal rights in any way. We are simply saying that those individuals that were found from 1981 forward, 1981 being the year that we enacted a law about involuntary commitments. From that time forward, individuals that had been involuntarily committed, not a 72-hour hold, but a 30-day due process, they had the right to an attorney, the whole works. If under those circumstances that person was involuntarily committed, that information is supposed to be provided to the Department of Public Safety. That needs to be provided to the Department of Public Safety to be in compliance with federal law currently, and there's actually some federal grants to make this happen. What we need is this particular statute to require that information to be shared. It helps with that data sharing. It does nothing more than those things. I think that then takes us just about to the end of the bill. The remaining sections in the bill after that, Madam Chair, we were on Section 49. Section 50 is the applicability section. Section 51 is the conditional effect because we're doing a court rule change. And then Section 52 just talks about it. Section 49 taking an immediate effect. And Section 53 says that all of the other sections would go into effect as of July 1. And that's the end of the bill.
Thank you for going through the sectional, and thank you, Senators, for allowing us to do this. This is the big bill. This is the sentencing bill. There are four criminal bills, 32, 33, 34, and 35, and this is the first of four, and it's the most complex one. Yes. I do appreciate everyone's patience going through this. We do have about 15 to 20 minutes to continue discussing this bill. And I would like to open it up for questions and conversations and clarifications. I do know that there is a spreadsheet that shows the comparison of pre-91 and this bill and the changes that's happening. And so that should help senators go through the sectional quickly, going through the spreadsheet and do a comparison. I'm finding it helpful. But now is available to have questions. And I see Senator Wilikowski has his hand up.
Thank you. Section 41, page 28. Looks like it's putting a misdemeanor for driving while license suspended, canceled. But then if you go to the bottom, it's also if the person drives in violation of a limitation placed on that person's license. If if there was a limitation that you had to wear glasses, for example, would you be committing a misdemeanor if you were driving without your glasses?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I don't think that's the limitation it's referring to. I think the limitation it's referring to is that you're only allowed to drive to and from work because you had a DUI. That's the sort of limited license that I think they're referring to. Having to have glasses, as I do when you drive, I don't think if you didn't have those glasses that that's what this is referring to.
Any other questions for Mr. Skidmore? Okay. So that concludes for today's meeting for Senate Bill 32. We are not going to do anything with this bill. We're going to set it aside, and we will review the fiscal notes later, and we will see this bill again. Tomorrow, we have Mr. David Teal at 9 a.m. with the Legislative Finance Department. And we are also going to see the next crime bill tomorrow after Mr. Teal, assuming that we have time, Senate Bill 35, which is crimes, sex crimes, and sentencing and parole. So we're going to be doing double time here with subject matter in regards to both the budget as well as crime. Those are two important subjects, so we'll be discussing both interchangeably and sometimes like tomorrow on the same day. So that's what we have to expect. And Senator Machicki.
Yeah, Madam Chair, it's a request for the Department of Law that they update the charts for those of you. These are very helpful, but they are a little behind. And if they can add Senate Bill 35 to these charts, that would be very helpful as well.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki. Senate Bill 35 really is not responding to anything that was in SB 91, which is why it's not on the chart. There's not a history to follow through in the same way. In terms of otherwise updating it, that is something that we're working on. There was another major piece of legislation that was just introduced in the House today. We're in the process of trying to analyze that. We do want to update the charts. We'll do our best to get it done timely, but there's a number of things we have on our plate at the moment.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Wait, Senator Wilson has a question.
Madam Chair, if we can all get a copy of the chart that's being referred to, that would be wonderful. Is it on basis or the chart that's being referenced?
Is it on basis?
Madam Chair, John Skidmore, I believe that the chart is on basis, but I'd be more than happy to make sure that we get you a copy.
Both electronically to the chair, to the co-chairs here, and then we can distribute to committee members.
Absolutely.
When it's finished after the new legislation that you just saw in the House.
Thank you.
I see Senator Bishop and then Senator, Senator Stedman and Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Yeah, I would just encourage you when you look at prioritizing your workload that Senate Finance Committee can work pretty fast. We're one of the last committees of referral. We're going to take up all the bills, and I would encourage you to try to make sure that you don't, or that you try to respond to the committee's requests and needs as quickly as possible and not get too distracted with bills too far down in other committees, because we have 3 weeks left, and we have no intention, or at least most of us have no intention of being here longer, so we don't really want to wait on your department.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, thank you. I'll take that into consideration.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Bishop.
Madam Chair, at some point, do you plan on having the Department of Public Safety at the table?
We can.
At that point, when you do, I have one question for them.
Okay, we don't have the Department of Public Safety today, but we can the next time that we see this bill, and so thank you for that suggestion. We have...
There are members of the department.
I apologize. Do we have someone from the Department of Safety here? Okay. I apologize. I see. Lisa, I'm on my game today, aren't I? Okay. And I see that Senator Reinbolt's been with us for a while. Okay.
Madam Chair, Mike Duxbury, Alaska Department of Public Safety Deputy Commissioner.
So... Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Duxbury. I don't know if you can speak on behalf of the commissioner, but this question will be for the commissioner, so I'll direct it to you. If you can't answer it, you can get back to me. Will this bill, once and for all, if it passes as is, will you be able to do your job and we won't have to listen to constituents say, well, because the law was changed, the public safety can't do their job, our hands are tied. Are your hands unbound now the way this bill is written and you can do your job?
Through the chair, Senator, that's a difficult question. I can't predict what the constituents in your area would say. I can tell you this, that when these bills have been introduced, the package in and of themselves provides us an ability to get back to having accountability and tools and discretion that we needed in order to make the impact that are both strategic in my viewpoint and also quality of life issues that your constituents are dealing with.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Wilson, followed by Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. I just want to clarify that. So you're saying you need all the bills, two bills, three bills? What package of bills are you referring to?
The entire package that was put forth by the governor's office are things that we are looking forward to being able to use in discretion to help the people of the state of Alaska.
Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. And I just want to sort of reiterate what Senator Bishop had asked and questioned was when we passed Senate Bill 91, we had the Attorney General, the Commissioner of Public Safety, the Commissioner of Corrections, all testify that we could pass that and it would keep us safe, and there was uniform support for it. And what we later found out was there were people in the trenches on the front line who didn't support the bill. And so my question to you is, is there support within the department from the troopers, from other people who are working out in the field for this bill, or do they have concerns about this, to your knowledge?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, what I can answer for you is that there is quite a few people in our outfit that see these as the opportunity to stop being the face of failure for your constituents that are complaining about what we're not able to accomplish on their behalf. I've made mentions of things like the drug crimes and the need for us to go back to the possession and the distribution limits, because they're driving property crimes, they're driving violent crimes, and those are really big important things to us. Could there be somebody in my department on the lower level that thinks we need to do something different? That is possible. Have we in the constituents and the people that we're dealing with in the department right now are pretty excited about getting back to being resourced to be successful to provide public safety to the people of Alaska. And when they're successful, all boats rise in the rising tide.
Thank you. We have Senator Marchicki followed by Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Duxbury. So we asked the question earlier if there will be increased arrests or people incarcerated of Department of Law, and I think that was the wrong department to ask, because they look at one aspect of it. But Department of Public Safety, are the folks under your command frustrated on the inability to intervene because the laws, the drug-related laws on both possession and distribution have been insufficient in stopping continued repeat offenses in the same communities, in the same neighborhoods, in the same houses over and over and over again? And do you think this will help with that issue?
Senator Matiki, through the chair. First answer is an overwhelming, resounding yes, and the second answer is an overwhelming, resounding yes.
Final.
Senator Matiki, follow up.
And then once your people under your command bother to make an arrest, have they been frustrated with the pretrial risk assessment that is returning individuals to where you, if you do bother to make arrest, you have an opportunity to arrest the same person over and over and over again?
Senator Michiki, through the chair, what I would say is a sentence that was repeated here again that I've said many times, and there was this sort of institutional inertia that was created by many aspects of what was taking place in SB 91 that couldn't help us prevent the re-victimization of people who were getting to before trial and before conviction, just coming right back out, sometimes re-victimizing the same house, the same people, the same business over and over and over again. So I believe the answer to your question is, yes, we're looking forward to being able to use these tools and the discretion, because not all public safety is authority. It is the discretion to help other people get into treatment. It is help to isolate those folks that are re-victimizing people and giving them a slowdown time, and having us have an ability to really feel like we were able to serve the people and take care of them.
Can I make a brief statement?
Brief statement.
Yes. I contend that recriminalizing possession is a lifesaver. Right now, people end up in prison for more serious crimes or dead. And way down on that probability curve is successful rehabilitation. I think, and I've talked to hundreds of people that have turned their lives around over time, and almost to the letter, their claim is that without that looking at long-term incarceration in the eye and possibly having some sort of deal, they would have never turned their lives around. I believe it's a lifesaver for those that have fallen victim to rehabilitation as well, and what we're doing is not working to help those individuals.
Thank you, Senator Michiki. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just would like Mr. Duckbury to enlighten us a little bit about this high-intensity drug trafficking area. I think it's a federal designation, and how expansive that is around the state, and if we're more expansive than other states, and then the follow-up with that answer, give us insight into the Mexican drug cartels that seem to be appearing around the state. I don't know about Anchorage and further north, but they're showing up in southeast. I think we've had a couple of arrests in Sitka. We had one gal shot once in each leg here a few months ago. And the courts are dealing with those characters. And I was wondering if we can get a little insight, and will this potential legislation help deviate this high-intensity drug trafficking area zone so we could possibly someday get out of it?
Senator Stedman, through the chair. What I know about the high-intensity drug trafficking area known as HIDA in its abbreviation is this. It's the first time in 17 years that the United States government, through the Office of the Drug Control Policy, known as the Drug Czar, has bestowed that designation on an independent area. So other states have had counties or whatever, but it's the first time in 17 years that a state's been it. We've been able to show that by providing the information that we could gather over the last couple of years to that department to show that we are in need. The next thing is it comes with federal funds. It's encouragement of something we've been doing for a long time. In Alaska, there's not enough drug enforcement, so we've always collaborated with everyone. We've collaborated with all the federal agencies that have any purview in it. We collaborate with the local police departments, and we get involved in task force. That is going to encourage more of that and provide resources for training, which is desperately needed because electronics and methods always change, and we have to stay ahead. The next thing that it's going to do for us is give us initiatives so that we can look at different ways to enforce the law, look at the conduits, the airports, and the ways that it's coming. To answer your second question, yes, sir, it is my knowledge that we are dealing with Mexican cartel individuals associated, members, and people making themselves associated from our population with traveling back and forth directly over the Mexican border and coming back to Alaska with drugs. Kodiak was mentioned earlier. It's one of the biggest places that we've been interacting with them. But I can sit on the plane and have folks from Kotzebue city council members tell me they're interacting with folks that appear to be the same folks. The reason being is Alaska is a place where a lot of money is made by distributing a very small amount of drugs.
Senator Stedman.
Mr. Fall, just so I'm clear, when you say Pacific site, you're referring to the entire state.
The HIDA, high-intensity drug trafficking area, is going to incorporate, for the state, it's going to incorporate three of the major, actually, I should put it this way, it's going to incorporate three of the judicial districts. The one judicial district that it isn't going to incorporate is basically the North Slope Borough and that, but here's how we've accomplished that. We've accomplished that because it is also a destination place for it, and we have incorporated and have for a number of years incorporated their officers into our teams in the areas where drugs are leaving to get to their locations. So we are in essentially, for all intents and purposes, have a statewide high-intensity drug trafficking area. It is run by an independent board made up of members of local police departments and the federal agencies, and it is a board that has a director for them to evaluate the problems in the areas and work on the issues. And it has local input, which is very important.
Thank you. You have another? Okay, Senator.
Yeah, just a real quick follow-up to a previous question about support outside of the area of the Capitol during Senate Bill 91. I found little in my district of that legislation, and a huge upswelling after that legislation was passed to correct it. And for those watching, that's basically all the islands in Southeast. So I think it's utmost important, Madam Chairman, that we deal with this piece of legislation and make sure it's sitting on the governor's desk for signature before we go home for the summer.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Thank you, Mr. Duxbury, for being here today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So that does conclude today's meeting. Again, tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., we're going to have Mr. David Teal as well as Senate Bill 35. So please enjoy your afternoon. It looks like it's sunny for the moment.